Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, Zora Langston met in 1925 when she first moved to Harlem. In 1927, they became really close because they met each other by accident in Mobile, Alabama. Zora was there doing some folklore research. Langston was there doing kind of a self-styled book tour. They met up in Mobile and decided to drive back to New York together in Zora's car, which she called Sassy Susie. Langston couldn't drive, but still, she enjoyed his company, and they traveled back together, and they drove all over the South, stopping off in different places, going to hoodoo doctors, and just having a great time. And they became just really, really close during that period. Zora went back to the South in 1928 and spent about 2 years studying, again, the folk ways of black folks in the South. That period is most beautifully documented by her letters to Langston Hughes. She was writing to him almost every day. They were writing to each other back and forth. They were just really close friends. I don't think there was any romantic relationship between them. You know, Langston Hughes, like many of the other men of Zora's circle, which they call themselves the Niggerati, you know, that circle, many of those men like County Cullen and Wallace Thurman and Richard Bruce Nugent were gay. And Zora was very clear about that and, you know, was comfortable with that. And even though Langston Hughes' sexuality has been debated and people just kind of don't know, I think, you know, he was sexually ambivalent, you know, to say the least. And Zora was aware of that. And so I don't think she had any romantic aspirations for their friendship, but she really regarded him as a brother, you know, and they were very close. They started working on this play together called Mule Bone, and they were both funded by the same patron, Charlotte Mason, who required everyone who benefited from her generosity to call her godmother. And Mrs. Mason was a 70-something white woman who was very controlling of the people she gave money to. And so she was putting pressure on both Zora and Langston with the work they were doing and actually disapproved of them writing this play together because she wanted Zora to be doing some other kind of work. And so in the middle of first secretly writing this play together, and then they got exposed by Godmother, and then they had to tell her the truth, there was just a lot of tension going on. And Godmother hired Louise Thompson to serve as their literary secretary. And Louise was a very bright young woman who Langston was friendly with already, and because she had already been working with him as a literary secretary. And so Langston started trying to make Louise more of a collaborator. He said, you know, she's too smart just to be a secretary in this case, you know. But it was Zora's story. It was set in Eatonville. It was a story that she had told ever since she moved to Harlem. So she objected to him trying to give Louise kind of an equal collaborative share in the project that she had brought to him. And so that was the beginning of their conflict. And it escalated because they didn't talk about it initially. You know, it was like a misunderstanding that spiraled out of control. And eventually Langston was in Cleveland. He saw a script of the play. You know, it looked as if Zora had sent this play to this theater to be produced without his name, but in fact she hadn't sent it there. She had given it to their mutual friend, Carl Van Vechten. He had given it to someone, and it ended up in Cleveland. So they both just had all these misunderstandings, and it just exacerbated to the point of a big blow-up, and they never really reconciled. You know, John Henry Clark said that it wasn't the kind of severe breakup that we think it was. It wasn't like they never spoke again. He said they still liked to laugh together, but they were never close like they used to be. And they both later regretted it. You know, that was in 1931. In 1934, Langston wrote to Carl Van Vechten and said, you know, I gave up all the rights to Mulebone, to Zora. Is she still mad at me? And 5 years after that, Zora told a mutual friend that her breakup with Langston was the cross of her life. And she still woke up at night crying about it. So they never really reconciled that friendship. So that's the Langston question. And
context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 10, 2018. So I have been told. This is our second and second to last study session on Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, written by Zora Neale Hurston, published posthumously in 2018. We're picking up on Chapter 3, the audio segment that you heard at the beginning from Valerie Boyd, author and literary scholar. She is, I believe, also the president of the Zora Neale Hurston Society. You can check that online to verify. But she did a great talk on Book TV about 15 years ago. And she gave a lot of information both about the book that we're reading and about the life and times of Zora Neale Hurston. And I thought the anecdote, because they only gave a snippet, I think I criticized the introduction of the text last week. I criticized there being no information about Charlotte Mason in terms of her being the godmother. I mean, they mentioned her being godmother, but they didn't even connect it clearly. Like, if you didn't know information about her beforehand, you would have been confused about who they were talking about. But I thought that was so important. We talk so consistently about conflict, racists keeping black people in conflict with each other, and to have such a sterling example of a race soldier white woman using her purse strings to manipulate and create conflict between two historic literary figures, Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. Just, if anything, when we read these books, especially when we read books that are non-fiction, Barracoon, non-fiction, that we should be trying to learn lessons. I think that definitely something to keep in mind from that anecdote. Wow. Not only minimizing conflict and being patient with other black people, but perhaps where constructive and applicable, looking for opportunities to reconcile with other black people. They talk all that hogwash about racial reconciliation with whites. How about perhaps being quick to practice racial or just reconciliation with other black people where applicable? Something to think about, I would hope. Anyway, and especially keeping in mind, whites, directly, indirectly, they are the root of a lot of these conflicts anyway. Really keeping that in the forefront of our mind, I think, super, super important. That's it. Zora Neale Hurston, Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, narrated by Robin Miles. We've heard from her before. Starting on Chapter 3, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter 3. When dey tried a man that steal the leopard hair, it did time to cut grass so he don't choke the corn. Before the grass be dry enough to burn, my grandpa he takes sick in his compound. How come he takes sick? Cutcho don't know. I little boy, and I don't know why he die. But Cutcho know his father take him to the compound of his father. I didn't see him after he died. They bury him right away so no enemy come look down in his face and do his spirit harm. They bury him in the house. They dig up the clay floor and bury him. we say in the Africa soil, we live with you while you alive. How come we can't live with you after you die? So, you know, they bury a man in his house. The coffin sitting there just like he in there. The people come fetch you presents and place them in the coffin. The first wife, she sat at the head of the coffin. When somebody came, she cried. She cried with a song. The other wives, they join in and cry with her. When we come in, the chief wife of my grandpa got up from the head of the coffin and throw the veil off her face. The other wives throw off the veil too. The chief wife, she weepy very loud and said, it is 40 years since he married me, and now you find me a widow. Only yesterday he was worried about his wives and children, and here he lies today in need of nothing. My father say, oh, the ground eats the best of everything. Then he weepy too. The chief wife, she cries some more, and the other wives cry and shake the voice. Aye, aye, aye. The chief wife say, he was a wonderful man. Then my father say, that is true. The ground can prove it. Then we set ourselves on the floor, and the wives cover up their faces and get it quiet. The man sorry he did too. They come bring presents and look at the coffin. They drink palm wine and sing sorrowful for him a song. O todo o wa en lo ya li o uran kanira ra kaniro ro. Then somebody else come and the chief wife she rise and start to weeping again. It very sad. They see the head of all the wives is shaved. They see the cover over the face. Therefore, you understand me. Everybody feels sad. The first wife, she cry and say, how long since we were married, and now we are nothing but a widow. The husband would know how to keep a woman. The husband would know how to prepare a house. The husband would know every secret of women. The husband would knows what is needed and gives it without asking. How long since we were married, and now we are nothing but a widow. They call my grandpa brave and praise-giving names. Then they cry with another song. Whoever shake the leaf of that tree, a sweet shrub, we are still smelling it. Whoever kill our husband, we shall never forget. The wives cry like that every time somebody come here. When nobody came, they sat quiet. 2 years, they must be widow. 1 year, they don't touch your water to the face. They wash it always with tears. In the Africa soil, the women grieve for their husband like that, you understand me? All day, all night, people come. And every time somebody come, the women cry. Kazula got that remote look in his eyes, and I knew he had withdrawn within himself. I arose to go. You going very soon today, he commented. Yes, I said. I don't want to wear out my welcome. I want you to let me come and talk with you again. Oh, I don't care you come see me. Could you like have company? Now I go water the tater vines. You see, can you find ripe peach on the tree and get it some take home? I put the ladder in the tree and climbed up in easy reach of a cluster of pink peaches. He saw me to the gate and graciously said goodbye. Don't come back till the next week. Now I need choppy grass in the garden. Chapter 4. In the 6 days between my visits to Kasula, I worried a little lest he deny himself to me. I had secured 2 Virginia hams on my trip south, and when I appeared before him the following Thursday, I brought him one. He was delighted beyond his vocabulary, but I read his face, and it was more than enough. The ham was for him. For us, I brought a huge watermelon right off the ice, so we cut it in half, and we just ate from heart to rind as far as we were able. Then it was necessary to walk it down. So he showed me over the old landmark Baptist church at his very gate, where he is the sexton. Watermelon, like too many other gorgeous things in life, is much too fleeting. We lightened our ballast and returned to the porch. Now you want me to tell you some more about what we do in the Africa soil? Well, you good to me. I don't care, I tell you something. It too hot, I work anyhow. My father, he name Ololue. He not a rich man. He had 3 wives. My mama, she named Nafondlolu. She the 2nd wife. Now that's right. Now no tell you I the son of the chief wife. That ain't right. I the son of the 2nd wife. My mama have 1 son before me, so I her 2nd child. She have 4 more children after me, but that ain't all the children my father got. He got 9 by the 1st wife and 3 by the 3rd wife. When the gulls marry, they like see how many children they can have for their husband. Aren't there some barren women? I asked. No, they all get children by their husband. If they don't get any babies, they go talk to the old folks. Then the old ones go in the bush and get it the leaves and make a tea and give the girls something to drink. Then they get the babies for their husband. Sometimes a woman don't never get a no baby, though. Kajo don't know why. In the compound, I play games with all the children my father got. We wrestle with one another. We see which one can run the fastest. We climb the palm tree with coconut on it, and we eat it at. We go in the woods and hunt the pineapple and banana, and we eat it at too. Know how we find the fruits? By the smell. Sometimes our mamas say we run play enough. They tell us, that too. Come sit down, and I tell you stories about the animals when they talk like folks. Kojo don't know the time when the animals talk like folks. The old folks, they tell me that. Kojo like very much to listen. I said, I like to hear stories too. Do you remember any other stories your mama told you? Well, said Kasula, I tell you the story next time you come set with me. Now I tell you about Kojo when he a boy back into Africa. One day, the chief send word to the compound. He wants to see all the boys that done see 14 rainy seasons. That making me very happy because I think he gonna send me to the army. I then almost 15 rainy seasons old. But in the Africa soil, they teach it the boys long time before they go in the army. Therefore, you understand me, when the boy about 14, they start training for the war. They don't go fight right away, no. First, they got to know how to walk in the bush and see and not show theyself. Therefore, first the fathers, elders, take the boys on journey to hunt. Sometime it go and come back before night. Sometime it 2-3 sleeps nights. They got to learn to step on the ground tracks. They got to know whether what they hunt turned this way or that way. They learn to break the branch and turn it so they can find their way back home. They got to knot the long leaf so the folks behind can know to follow. The fathers teach us to know a place for the house, a campsite, and how we must chop a bark or the biggest tree so somebody else would go running, traveling, can know it a good place to sleep. We make the hunt many times. We shoot the arrows from the bow. We chunk a spear. We kill the beasts and fetch them home with us. I'm so glad I'm going to be a man and fight in the army like my big brothers. I like it beating the drum, too. They teach us to sing the war song. We sing when we walk in the bush and make like we go and fight the enemy. The drum talking with us when we sing the song. Ofu, ofu, tiggy, 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 batim. Ofu, ofu, tiggy, 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 batim. Ofu, batim, enko ese. When the day breaks, the cock shall crow. When the day breaks, the cock shall crow. When the day breaks, the cock shall crow. When someone crosses our roof, we shall tear a nation down. The actual meaning is, when we get there, we shall make our demands, and if we are crossed, we shall tear down the nation who defies us. Every year they teach us more war, but the king, Akiayon, say he don't go make no war. He make us strong, so nobody don't make war on us. We know the secret of the gates, so when the enemy come and we don't know they come, we can run, hide ourselves in the bush, then they don't see nobody, they go away. Then we come behind them and fight till they all dead. 4 or 5 rainy seasons it keep on like that. Then I grow tall and big. I can run in the bush all day and not be tired. Kazula ceased speaking and looked pointedly at his melon rind. There was still lots of good red meat and a quart or two of juice. I looked at mine. I had more meat left than Kazula had. Nothing was left of the first installment but a pleasant memory. So we lifted the half rinds to our knees and started all over again. The sun was still hot, so we did the job leisurely. Watermelon halves having ends like everything else, and a thorough watermelon eating being what it is, a long, overstuffed silence fell on us. When I was able to speak, somehow the name Juju came into my mind, so I asked Kazula what he knew about it. He seemed reluctant to answer my question, but finally he did so. I tell you what I know about the Juju. What the old folks do in the Juju house, I don't know. I can't tell you that. Not too young yet. That don't reach in me. I know that all the grown men, they go to the mountain once a year. It have something to do with making the weather, but what they do there, Kudja don't know. Now, that's right. I don't make out I know what go on with the grown folks. When I come away from Afiki, I only a boy 19-year-old. I have one initiation. A boy must go through many initiations before he become a man. I just initiate one time. One day, I was in a marketplace when I see a pretty girl walk past me. She's so pretty, I follow her a little way, but I don't speak. We don't do that in Afiki. But I like you. One old man, he saw me watch the girl. He don't say nothing to me. But he went to my father and say, your boy is about breaking the corn. He is getting to be a man and knows the secret of man. So put goats down or a cow and let us fix a banquet for him. So my father say, all right. But first they don't fix the banquet for me. They have in Afiki a small stick on a string, and when they make it go round fast, it roar like the lion or the bull. They have 3 kinds. One, they call it the he, one the she, and one they call it the dog, because they make it bark that way. The bull roar. No woman must hear this thing. If she do, she die. So they stay inside and shut the door tight. They put me in the initiation house. After a while, I hear a great roaring outside the door, and they say to me, go see where that is. Soon as I went outside, I don't hear it at the door no more. It sound way off in the bush. They tell me to go in the bush to hunt it. As soon as I go in the bush to find out what it is, I hear it behind me. I hear it behind me, in front of me, everywhere. But I never find it. The men are playing with me. Way after a while, they take me into the banquet and tell me the secret of the thing that make that sound. At the banquet, they make me sit and listen with respect. They tell me, you are just below us. You are not yet a man. All men are still fathers to you. There's plenty of roast meat and wine at the banquet, and all the men, they pinch in my ear tight to teach me to keep the secrets. Then I get a peacock feather to wear. In American soil, I see plenty of women wear the peacock feather, but they don't know what they do. In Africa's soil, a boy got to get plenty of secrets inside that he don't talk before he get it a peacock feather. Chapter 5. When I get it a peacock feather, I stand round the place where the chief talk with the wise men. I hope they see Kudjo and think he a grown man. Maybe they call me to the council. The fathers don't never call me, but I like it very much to be there and listen when they talk. I like he go in the marketplace, too, and see the pretty gals with the gold bracelets on the arm from the hand to the elbow. Oh, they look very fine to cudgel when they walkie. They sling the arms so, and the bracelet ring. I like hear that. It sounds so pretty. One day, I see one girl I like very much to marry, but I too young to take a wife. But I like her. I think about her all the time. Therefore, I go home and say to my folks, be careful how you treat such and such a girl. They look at me, then they go ask for the girl to be my wife when I get a little older. One day, therefore, I in the market. Three men come, what's strange to us. They say they from Dahomey, and they want to see our king. The king say, all right. He talk with them. They say, you know the king of Dahomey? Akiyon say, I have heard of him. The men from Dahomey say, then you know all the strong names he got. You know he got one name, Tenge Makangfengpa, a rock. The fingernail cannot scratch it, see? You know they speak about him and say, kini, 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 lion of lions. Some say, an animal done cut its teeth, evil done enter into the bush. The bush, meaning the surrounding tribes who feel the sharpness of Dahomey's tooth. This king send to you and say he wish to be kind. Therefore, you must send him the half your crops. If you don't send it, he make war. Our king Akiyon say, as to you king, did he ever hear the strong name of Akiyon? They call me Mouth of the Leopard. That he take hold on, he never let go. Tell him the crops ain't mine, they belong to the people. I can't send and take the people crops to send to the king of Dahomey. He got plenty land. Let him stop making slave hunt on other people and make his own crops. The king of Dahomey don't like that message, but Akiyon so strong, he afraid to come make war, so he wait. The king of Dahomey, you know, he got very rich catching slaves. He keep his army all the time making raids to grab it people to sell to the people of Dahomey. Don't have no time to raise gardens and make food for themselves. Maybe the king of Dahomey never come make raid in Tekoi. But one traitor from Tekoi go into Dahomey. He a very bad man and the king of Tekoi say, leave this country. That man want big honors in the army, so he go straight in the Dahomey and say to the king, I show you how to take it, Tekoi. He tell it them the secret of the gates. Therefore, you understand me. They come make war, but we don't know they come fight us. They march all night long and we in the bed sleep. We don't know nothing. It about daybreak when the folks that sleep get wake with the noise when the people of Dahomey breaky the great gate. I not woke yet, I still in bed. I hear the gate when they break it. I hear the yell from the soldiers while they choppy the gate. Therefore I jump out the bed and looky. I see the great many soldiers with French gun in the hand and the big knife. They got the women soldiers too, and they run with the big knife and make noise. They catch people, and they saw the neck like this with the knife. Then they twist the head so, and it come off the neck. Oh, Lord, Lord. I see the people get to kill so fast. The old ones, they try run away from the house, but they dead by the door, and the women soldiers got their head. Oh, Lord. Kodjo wept sorrowfully and crossed his arms on his breast with the fingers touching his shoulders, his mouth and eyes wide open as if he still saw the gruesome spectacle. Everybody, they run to the gate so they can hide themselves in the bush, you understand me? Some never reach the gate. The women soldier catch the young ones and tie them by the wrist. No man can be so strong like the women soldiers from the Dahomey. So they cut off the head. Some they snatch the jawbone while the people ain't dead. Oh, Lord, Lord. Law. The poor folks with their bottom jaw tore off their face. I run it fast to the gate, but some of the men from the army, they there too. I run it to the next gate, but they there too. They surround the whole town. They at all the 8 gates. One gate looking like nobody there, so I make haste and run it towards the bush. But the man of the homie, they there too. Soon as I get out the gate, they grabbing me and tie the wrist. I beg them, please, let me go back to my mama, but they don't pay what I say, no attention. They tie me with the rest. While they catching me, the king of my country, he come out the gate and they grab him. They see he the king, so they very glad. Therefore, you understand me, they take him in the bush where the king of the homie wait with some chiefs till Tekoi be destroyed. When he see our king, he say to his soldiers, bring me the word changer, public interpreter. When the word changer came, he say, ask this man why he put his weakness again the line of the homie. The man changed the words for our king. Akion listen. Then he say to the Dahomey king, why don't you fight like men? Why you don't come in the daytime so that we can meet face to face? The man changed the words so the king of Dahomey know what he say. Then the king of Dahomey say, get in line to go to Dahomey so the nations can see I conquer you and sell Akion in the barracoon. Akion say, I ain't going to Dahomey. I born a king in Tekoi where my father and his father's rule before I was born. Since I've been a full man, I rule. I die a king, but I not be no slave. The king of Dahomey ask him, you not going to Dahomey? He tell him, no, he ain't going off the ground where he is the king. The king of Dahomey don't say no more. He look at the soldier and point at the king. One woman soldier step up with the machete and chop off the head of the king and pick it off the ground and hand it to the king of Dahomey. When I see the king dead, I try to escape from the soldiers. I try to make it to the bush, but all the soldiers overtake me before I get there. Oh, Lord. Lord. When I think about that time, I try not to cry no more. My eyes, they stop crying, but the tears running down inside me all the time. When they men pull me with them, I call my mama name. I don't know where she is. I don't see none of my family. I don't know where they is. I beg the men to let me go find them, my folks. The soldiers say they got no ears for crying. The king of Dahomey come to hunt slave to sell. So they tie me in the line with the rest. The sun, it just rising. All day they make us walk, the sun so hot. The king of Dahomey, he ride in the hammock. And the chiefs with him, they got hammock too. Po' me, I walk. The men of Dahomey, they tie us in the line, so nobody run off. In their hand, they got the head of the people that kill in Tekoi. Some got 2-3 head they carry with them to Dahomey. That's so sad for my home. I ain't getting hungry that day, but I glad when we drink the water. Before the sun go down, we come by a town. It got a red flag on the bush. The king of Dahomey send men with the word changer to the town, and the chief come in the hammock and talk with the king. Then he take down the red flag and hang a white flag. What they say, Cudjo don't know. But he bring the king a present of yams and corn. The soldiers make fire and cook the grub and eat it. Then we march on. Every town the king send message. We sleepy on the ground that night. But the king and the chiefs hang their hammock in the tree and sleepy in them. Then nothing don't harm them on the ground. For me, I sleepy on the ground and cry. I ain't used to no ground. I think here too about my folks and I cry. All night I cry. When the sun rise, we eat and march on to the homie. The king send word to every time we pass it. And the headman come out. If they got a red flag, that mean they agree they ain't gonna pay no tax to the Dahomey. They say they will fight. If it a white flag, they pay to Dahomey what they asked of them. If it a black flag, that mean that the ruler is dead and the son not old enough to take the throne. In the Africa soul, when they see the black flag, they don't bother. They know it'd be taking advantage if they make war when nobody in charge. The heads of the men of Dahomey got gin to smell very bad. Oh, Lord, I wish they buried them. I don't like seeing my people head in the soldiers' hands. And the smell making me so sick. The next day, they make camp all day so that the people can smoke the heads so they don't spoil no more. Oh, Lord, 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 we got to sit there and see the heads of our people smoking on the stick. We stay there in that place the 9 days. Then we march on to the Dahomey soil. Kazula was no longer on the porch with me. He was squatting about that fire in Dahomey. His face was twitching in abysmal pain. It was a horror mask. He had forgotten that I was there. He was thinking aloud and gazing into the dead faces in the smoke. His agony was so acute that he became inarticulate. He never noticed my preparation to leave him. So I slipped away as quietly as possible and left him with his smoke pictures. Chapter 6. Barracoon. It was Saturday when next I saw Cudjo. He was gracious, but not too cordial. He picked me peaches and tried to get rid of me quickly, but I hung on. Finally, he said, "Didn't I tell you not to come bother me on Saturday? I got to clean the church. Tomorrow's Sunday." "But I came to help you, Kazula. You needn't talk if you don't want to." "I thank you come help me. I want you to take me in a car into Mobile. I getting me some turnip seed to plant in the garden." We hurriedly swept and dusted the church. Less than an hour later, the Chevrolet had borne us to Mobile and back. I left him at his gate with a brief goodbye and tackled him again on Monday. He was very warm this day. He glimmered and glinted with light. I must first tell him about the nice white lady in New York who was interested in him. "I want you to write her a letter into New York. Tell her Cudjo say 1,000 times, much obliged. I glad she sent you asking me what Cudjo do all the time." I talked about the lady for a few minutes, and my words evidently pleased him, for he said, "I tell you more about Cudjo when he was in the Dahomey. I tell you right. She good to me. You tell her Cudjo like please her. She good to me and Cudjo lonely." They march us into Dahomey, and I see the house of the king. I can't tell all the times we pass it to get to the place where the king got his house. But I remember we pass it the place called Echo, Meko, and Ajase. We go in the city where the king's got his house, and they call it Lomi. Either Abomey or Cana. The house the king live in himself, you understand me. It made out of skull bones. Maybe it not made out of the skull, but it look it that way to Cudjo. Oh, Lord. They got the white skull bone on the stick when they come meet us. And the men what march in front of us, they got their fresh head high on the stick. The drum beat so much, look it like the whole world is the drum they beat on. That the way they fetch us into the place where the king got his house. They place us in the barracoon, stockade, and we rest there ourselves. They give us something to eat, but not very much. We stay there 3 days. Then they have a feast. Everybody sing and dance and beat the drum. We stay there not many days. Then they march us to Esoku, the sea. We pass here a place called Budigree, Budigree. Then we come into a place called Dwida. It is called Widda by the whites, but Dwida is the Nigerian pronunciation of the place. When we get into place, they put us in a barracoon behind a big white house, and they feed us some rice. We stay there in the barracoon 3 weeks. We see many ships in the sea, but we can't see so good, because the white house is between us and the sea. The cudgels see the white men, and that's something he ain't never seen before. In the Takoi, we hear to talk about the white man, but he don't come there. The barracoon we in ain't the only slave pen at the place. They got plenty of them, but we don't know who the people in the other pens. Sometime we holler back and forth and find out where each other come from, but each nation in a barracoon by itself. We not so sad now. We all young folks, so we play game and clam up beside the barracoon so we can see what going on outside. When we there 3 weeks, a white man come into barracoon with 2 men of the Dahomey. One man, he a chief of Dahomey, and the other one, his word changer. They make everybody stand in a ring, about 10 folks in each ring. The men by they self, the women by they self. Then the white man looky. He looky hard at the skin and the feet and the legs and in the mouth. Then he choose. Every time he choose a man, he choose a woman. Every time he take a woman, he take a man too. Therefore, you understand me, he take 130. 65 men with a woman for each man, that's right. Then the white man go away. I think he go back in the White House. But the people of Dahomey come bring us a lot of grub for us to eat it, because they say we going to leave there. We eat it a big feast. Then we cry. We sad, because we don't want to leave the rest of our people in the barracoon. We all lonesome for our home. We don't know what going to become of us. We don't want to be put apart from one another. But they come. And tie us in the line and lead us round the big white house. Then we see so many ships in the sea. Cudgel see many white men, too. They talking with the officers of the Dahomey. We see the white man that buy us. When he see us ready, he say goodbye to the chief and giddy in his hammock and they carry him across the river. We walk behind and wade the water. It come up to the neck. And cudgel think once he gon' drown. But nobody drown, and we come on the land by the sea. The shore, it full of boats of many costs. The boats take something to the ships and fetch something away from the ships. They coming and going all the time. Some boat got white man in it. Some boat got poor African in it. The man that buys, he get in a crew boat and go out to the ship. They take the chain off us and place us in the boats. Cudjo don't know how many boats take us out on the water to the ship. I, in the last boat, go out. They almost leaving me on the shore. But when I see my friend Kibi in the boat, I won't go with him. So I holler. They turn round and take him. When we're ready to leave the crew boat and go in the ship, the many costs snatch our country cloth off us. We try to save our clothes. We ain't used to be without no clothes on. But they snatch all off us. They say, you get plenty of clothes where you going. Oh, Lord, I so ashamed. We come to America so naked. And the people say we naked savage. They say we don't wear no clothes. They don't know the many costs snatch our clothes away from us. Soon we get in the ship. They make us lay down in the dark. We stay there 13 days. They don't give us much to eat. Me so thirst. They give us a little bit of water twice a day. Oh, Lord, Lord, we so thirst. The water tastes sour. Footnote. Vinegar was usually added to the water to prevent scurvy. End of footnote. On the 13th day, they fetch us on the deck. We so weak we ain't able to walk ourselves. So the crew take each one and walk round the deck till we get so we can walk ourselves. We looky and looky and looky and looky, and we don't see nothing but water. Where we come from, we don't know. Where we going, we don't know. The boat we own, called the Clotilda, Cudjo suffer so in that ship, oh Lord. I so scared on the sea. The water, you understand me, it make it so much noise. It growl like the thousand beasties in the bush. The wind got so much voice on the water. Oh, Lord. Sometimes the ship way up in the sky. Sometimes it way down in the bottom of the sea. They say the sea was calm. Cudjo don't know. Seem like it move all the time. One day, the color of the water change, and we see some islands. But we don't come to the shore for 70 days. One day we see the color of the water change, and that night we stop by the land. But we don't get off the ship. They send us back down in the ship, and the next morning, they bring us the green branch off the tree. So we Africans know we about finished the journey. We been on the water 70 days, and we spend some time lying down in the ship till we tired. But many days we on the deck. Nobody ain't sick, and nobody ain't dead. Captain Bill Foster, good man. He don't abuse us and treat us mean on the ship. They tell me it a Sunday us way down in the ship and tell us to keep quiet. Captain Bill Foster, you understand me, he's scared the government folks in the Fort Monroe gonna catch the ship. When at night the ship move again. Cudjo didn't know then what they do, but they tell me they towed the ship up the Spanish Creek to 12 Mile Island. They took us off the ship, and we get on another ship. Then they burn the Clotilda because they scared the government gonna arrest them for fetching us away from Africa soil. First, they divide us with some clothes. Then they carry us up the Alabama River and hide us in the swamp. But the mosquitoes, they so bad, they about to eat us up. So they took us to Captain Burn Mayer's place and divide us up. Captain Tim Mayer, he took it 32 of us. Captain Burns Mayer, he took it 10 couples. Some they sell up the river in the Boga Chitta. Captain Bill Foster, he took it to 8 couples. And Captain Jim Mayer, he get it the rest. We very sorry to be parted from one another. We cry for home. We took away from our people. We 70 days crossed the water from the Africa soil. And now they part us from one another. Therefore we cry. We can't help but cry. So we sing. Eh, ye, aye. La na se wu. Re, re, aye. Na na sa horu. Our grief so heavy. Look like we can't stand it. I think maybe I die in my sleep. When I dream about my mama. Oh, Lord. Kozula sat silent for a moment. I saw the old sorrow seep away from his eyes, and the present take its place. He looked about him for a moment and then said bluntly, I'm tired talking now. You go home and come back. If I talk it with you all the time, I can't make it no garden. You won't know too much. You asked it so many questions. That do, that do. That will do, etc. Go on home. I was far from being offended. I merely said, well, when can I come again? I send my grandson a letter, you know. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe next week. Chapter 7. Slavery. Cap'n Jim, he took me. He make a place for us to sleep it underneath the house. Not on the ground, you understand me. The house, it high off the grounds and got the bricks underneath for the floor. They give us bed and bed cover, but tain't enough to keep us warm. They don't put us to work right away, cause we don't understand what they say and how they do. But the others show us how they raise the crop in the field. We are astonished to see the mule behind a plow to pull. Captain Tim and Captain Burns may work at they folks hard. They got overseer with the whip. One man tried whipping one my country women, and they all jump on him and take the whip away from him and lash him with it. He don't never try whip African women no more. The work very hard for us to do, cause we ain't used to work it like that. But we don't grieve about that. We cry cause we slave. In that time we cry. We say we born and raised to be free people and now we slave. We don't know why we bring weight from our country to work like this. It's strange to us. Everybody looking at us strange. We want to talk with the other colored folks, but they don't know what we say. Some make it a fun at us. Captain Jim, he a good man. He not like his brother Captain Tim. He don't want his folks knocking beat all the time. He see my shoes get a raggedy, you know, and he say, Kajo, if that the best shoes you got, I get you some more. Now that's right. I no tell it lies. He work us hard, you understand me? But he don't work at his folks like his brother. They got the 2 plantation, one on the Tennessee River and one on the Alabama River. Oh, Lord, appreciate they free me. We don't have enough bed clothes. We work it so hard. The women still work here in the field, too. We not in the field much. Captain Jim got it 5 boats run from the Mobile to the Montgomery. Oh, Lord, I work it so hard. Every landing, you understand me, I tote wood on the boat. They have the freight, you understand me, and we have to tote that, too. Oh, Lord, I'm so tired. No sleeping. The boat leak and we pump it so hard. They ain't got no railing on the boat. And in the nighttime, if you don't watch it close, you fall overboard and drown yourself. Oh, Lord, I appreciate they free me. Every time the boat stop it at the landing, you understand me? The overseer, they whipping boss, he go down the gangplank and stand on the ground. The whip sticky in his belt. He holler, hurry up there, you. Run it fast. Can't you run it no faster than that? You ain't got enough load. Hurry up. He cut you with the whip if you ain't run fast enough to please him. If you don't get a big load, he hit you too. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. 5 years and 6 months I slave. I work it so hard. Look alike, now I see all the landings. I call all them for you. The first landing, after the Mobile, it the 21-mile bluff. The next, it the Chestang. The next, it the mouth of the Tennessee. Then the 4 gun shorter. Then we pass Tom Bigby. Then the next, it the Montgomery Hill. Then the next, it Choctaw Bluff. Then the Gaintown. Then Tay Creek. Then Annapolis. Then Claiborne. Then Low Peach Tree. Then Upper Peach Tree. Then we come to the White Bluffs, then the Blue Bluffs. The next year after that, it the Yellow Jacket. The river, it is shallow there sometime. The boat have to wait for the tide. The next year after that is Cahoba, then Selma, then Bear Landing, then Washington, then the last place it'd be Montgomery. I think I remember them, you understand me, but I ain't been there since 1865. Maybe I forget it some. Don't look it like I never forget. I work so hard and we ain't had nothing to sleep it on but the flow. Sometimes the bluff is so high, we got to chunk the wood down to 3 times before it get down where the river is. The steamboat didn't used to burn it the coal. It burned it the wood, and it uses so much of wood. The war commences, but we don't know about it when it start. We see the white folks running up and down. They go into Mobile, they come out on the plantation. Then somebody tell me the folks is way up in the north make the war so they free us. I like hear that. Cause I don't want to be no slave. But we wait and wait. We hear the guns shoot us sometime, but nobody don't come tell us we free. So we think maybe they fight about something else. The Yankees they at Fort Morgan, you understand me. They're there on account of the war, and they don't let nothing come past them. So poor folks, they ain't got no coffee or nothing. We parch the rice and make it a coffee. Then we ain't got no sugar. So we put the molasses in the coffee. That don't taste so good, you understand me, but nobody can't do nothing about it. Captain Jim may have sent word he don't want us to starve, you understand me? So he tell us to kill hogs. He say the hogs, they his, and we his, and he don't want in no dead folks. Therefore, you know, we killing hogs, but we can't get in nothing. When we at the plantation on Sunday, we so glad we ain't got no work to do. So we dance like in the Africa soil. The American colored folks, you understand me? They say we savage, and then they laugh at us and don't come say nothing to us. But Free George, you understand me, he, a colored man, don't belong to nobody. His wife, you understand me, she been free long time. So she cook for a Creole man and buy George 'cause she married with him. Free George, he come to us and tell us not to dance on Sunday. Then he tell us what Sunday is. We don't know what it is before. Nobody in Africa saw don't tell us about no Sunday. Then we don't dance no more on the Sunday. Know how we get a free? Could you tell you that? The boat I own, it in the Mobile. We all on there to go into Montgomery, but Captain Jim Mayer, he not on the boat that day. Cudjo don't know why. I don't forget. It April 12, 1865. The Yankee soldiers, they come down to the boat and eat the mulberries off the trees close to the boat, you understand me? Then they see us on the boat and they say, y'all can't stay there no more. You free. You don't belong to nobody no more. Oh, Lord, I'm so glad. We asked the soldiers where we going. They say they don't know. They told us to go where we feel like going. We ain't no more slave. Thank the Lord. I so appreciate they free me. Some of the men, they owned a steamboat in the Montgomery and they got to come into Mobile and unload the cargo. Then they free too. We ain't got no trunks or we make it a bundles. We ain't got no house, so somebody tell us come sleepy in the section house. We done that till we could get it ourselves someplace to go. Cudger don't care. He a free man then.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, all done. We will start Freedom, Chapter 8. That's what we'll pick up at for the second audio segment. If you would like to call in, if you have questions, comments, thoughts, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks wrote commentary in as well. In fact, I will do the written commentary first. I will save my own notes, but I do appreciate lots more people, like way more people listen to the archives than the actual live broadcast. So lots of people, you know, listen whenever they get to it and just, you know, write in their commentary when they have a free moment. One of the folks who wrote in about Invisible Man also had commentary for Barracoon as well. So their commentary for Barracoon. He says, I'm writing regarding the question you posed regarding the role that Africans played in the European slave trade. I found the opinions of both you and the callers insightful regarding the topic. I agree that suspected racist white supremacists, not surprisingly, have left out important details and distorted the history of this period. Walter Rodney's book, titled How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, published in 1972, provides information regarding resistance by Africans regarding Europeans' desire to trade in African people.
This is a lot. I'm not going to read a whole lot of quotes from another person's book while we're on this book, but Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, published in 1972. Reading is more important than watching television. Maybe we should read that on the book club. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, what we heard in the first section, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The part where he says that you are not a man yet, all men are still fathers to you, lets us know the civilization that they, you know, the civilization that they had over in Africa, unlike the, you know, false narrative of Africans being savage. You know, they understood the context of families, and that, you know, boys are not fathers, and basically all the men take care of, you know, the children, whether they're theirs or not. So really appreciated hearing about that. When he described the invasion of the Dahomey warriors, and he said that there were many soldiers with French guns, that right there shows the complicity of the white people giving guns to the other Africans to, you know, do their dirty work. Obviously, in white supremacy can't be this grand system of global domination unless you have agents to carry out your system, since, you know, on the planet, they are a minority number-wise, but, you know, you have to have, you know, some sort of agents to carry out your, you know, your terrorist acts in remote parts of the world where you have to dominate, because, you know, not all the places in the world are, you know, firsthand run by white people, so they have to use different people like the Dahomey kingdoms to, you know, practice, you know, their barbaric slave trade. And also going back to the false narrative of Africans being savage, because when Asula was talking about how they snatched the clothes off of them and basically had them, you know, bare naked, you know, it's like, you know, that was kind of a shame, you know, for them to be that way. And then when they get here, everybody thinks that they're savages because they think that's the way they dress. And Kasula, you know, verifies it that, yeah, we had clothes back then. So and he knew, you know, what was to come in regards to the way they looked at his people. So that's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Appreciate the commentary, sir. Mr. Demery Ford, if you had commentary, you should be with us, sir.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Like you mentioned last time, I think that I'll try to refer to Cujo as Kasula. So Kasula is his real name. And I think in our last readings, we noticed that, well, when she was talking to him, he smoked a pipe. He measured the years in the rainy season. And when they got on the subject of God, it reminds you that whites, you know, go to great lengths to make sure that their version of religion becomes the dominant belief system for non-whites. And although they didn't believe that black people had souls, they were still offering them a religion of soul salvation. I thought that was kind of ironic, but now we know that, you know, what was driving the whites' greed, leading them to Africa in the first place, you know, to rob them of their resources, gold, ivory, iron, the land, and black bodies. We heard Kazulu was telling us about the tribal court system, the trying of murders, executions for punishment, going into detail with the raids, wars, and the cutting off of heads, and describing a funeral in great detail. I think that a lot of this is a lot of white footprints on this, on what gets, you know, printed. Because like you said before, I guess it was Miss Charlotte Mason was providing a lot of finances, so then she tried to have a lot of say so on which way that these narratives were going. So it just seems like if a person is talking about their native land, it don't seem like the majority of what he would be saying would be, you know, those things that I brought up before. So I think that's evidence of interference there from the, I think, the godmother, the white female, Charlotte Mason, and others. But he mentioned herbs and leaves that was used for medicine, even fertility drugs and the making of banana beer. So he got into some of the cultural things like the initiations, you know, but we have to, I think, imagine that, you know, we have millions of inhabitants in Africa, and then all these thousands of tribal people, you know, away from the main trade outlets, because there's a whole different world in the bush than when it was in the more bustling trade centers, because trades had been going on for, you know, thousands of years, and they were familiar with a lot of African tribes that wasn't far off in the bush, were familiar with white people and their trading in human flesh. And so when they started, when he started to talk about how the Dahomey tribe, you know, was getting rich in the slave trade, it probably wasn't uncommon to actually just concentrate in that area, like this Dahomey king. And I thought it was interesting that the women, Dahomey women, participated in the raids, and that he said, no man can be so strong like the women soldiers from Dahomey. And that was in contrast with, say, the images of the females he had from his tribal experiences, his father and grandfather's wives, and taking care of the men folk. That point, where the point of no return, the Barracoons, where they spent months captive, waiting on the ships to return to be loaded again. That was a horrific experience. And a lot of those structures were underneath so-called sacred meeting places like churches, other administrative buildings. Underneath there would be where they would be holding human cargo and causing people to suffer. And it sounded up in Chapter 5 like Kazula was still struggling with repressed memories, because he would go in and out of the interview and look like from an entire life being victimized by the system of white supremacy. And the trip over, one sip of water twice a day and not much to eat. And then the differences between Captain Jim and Captain Tim. Captain Jim, I think, if I remember correctly, he thought was a good man, simply because he didn't whip as much as Captain Tim. But even Captain Jim, when the war was over, failed to tell his slaves that they were free, and even had them working even past emancipation. And even after that, what type of work could you get even after the emancipation? Is probably similar to slave work anyway. I'll mute my lines on that. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. I will keep an eye out for folks who have a hand up, have commentary. An investor shared a very interesting article. You all can check it out. I posted it on Facebook. I'll tweet it as well. You all can view it at your leisure. From LA Review of Books. LA Review of Books. A Different Backstory for Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon by Rebecca Panofka. I think I'm saying that correctly. P-A-N-O-V-K-A. Panofka. Sorry if I mispronounced. So I'm going to scroll down. I'm not going to read the entire section, but I'll try to pick up where it gets really juicy and share. I'll share until I get tired of reading. So she talks about how this book was released after decades of being shelved, why it wasn't published in the 30s, and HarperCollins bragging about, you know, what a hoot to have this book published now, and it's got all these rave reviews in the New York Times and the Washington Post, etc. So I'll begin. All that may be true, but it's an incomplete version of events. The pressures and preferences of the publishing world do not on their own explain why Hurston chose to withdraw Barracoon from the consideration of an interested editor. That incident, as far as I'm aware, is not mentioned in any of the critical or biographical literature about Hurston. It is recorded in hour-by-hour detail, though, in Locke's archive at Howard University's Moreland Spingarn Library. What a name that has come up so many times on the Cows Book Club, specifically Little Rock Nine segments that we did specifically. Locke documented the whole publication process for Barracoon in a series of letters, as well as a formal memorandum, all addressed to a single recipient. A woman, a white woman named Charlotte Osgood Mason. I'm going to hold the hand up for the follow through because I did pick a great audio segment for this today. And they have a photo of the white woman in between, racist suspected race soldier. Even the long form pieces on Barracoon largely gloss over the fact that when the text was being researched and written, both Hurston and Lewis were engaged in a strange, coercive relationship with Mason, a wealthy white person who wanted to use the book to fulfill her, in quotes, mystical vision of a great bridge reaching from Harlem to the heart of Africa, end quote. Mason paid both Hurston and Lewis stipends for years. She imagined Barracoon as an object with supernatural powers and laid the material groundwork for its creation. It was due to Mason's intervention that Hurston's manuscript made its way to Viking in the first place. Her support of Hurston was contingent in part on Barracoon's publication. Charlotte Osgood Mason was the widow of Dr. Rufus Osgood Mason, a noted surgeon and pioneer in the field of parapsychology, psychology of the paranormal, which at the time placed him squarely in the realm of respectable scientific inquiry. Publishing titles like Telepathy and the Subliminal Self, Dr. Mason believed that the phenomena he studied, telepathy, clairvoyance, thought transference, and even artistic genius, resulted from the as-yet unstudied subliminal self, which allowed individuals to tap into the all-pervading divine mind. By overvaluing the rational, he argued, Western civilization had silenced the subliminal and therefore become abnormal, unsymmetrical, deformed, and tending to disintegration. Helping patients tap into their subliminal selves, Dr. Mason wrote, was the most important work now being done in the world. Even before her marriage, Charlotte Mason had dreamt of a flaming pathway to Africa, which she believed would serve as a cure for American society by unleashing the creative impulse throbbing in the African race, all in quotes. There was never a time, she said, when I was not interested in primitive peoples, end quotes. In her youth, she had conducted amateur ethnographic fieldwork among the Native American tribes of the Southwest, and once married, she wedded her long-standing interest with her husband's anti-rationalist philosophy to produce a bizarre occultist ideology all her own. Mason thought of herself as a psychologist of the times. White civilization is already in the throes of death, she wrote. Its spiritual life is choked. The solution, she believed, was to be found in primitive art, which could teach a white audience the value of the subliminal. According to Mason, primitive art shows a great genius stream flowing slowly, surely, through a race, because the stream isn't lost by egotism, all in quotes. Mason used egotism as a stand-in for what her husband described as the rational mind. Rufus Osgood Mason died in 1903, leaving his 49-year-old widow a fortune and a precious burden, his legacy. By making primitive art available to a white upper-class audience, Charlotte Mason resolved she would use her inheritance to cure the spiritual disintegration her husband had diagnosed. Mason began by returning to the Southwest with ethnomusicologist Natalie Curtis. Together, the two women collected tales and songs for what became the Indian's Book, which Mason considered an eternal glory for the rest of her life. Mason was in her 70s when she met Alan Locke at a 1927 showing of African art, and she reported in her journal
a tremendous rapport with the young professor, a graduate of Harvard and Oxford, where he had studied as the first Black Rhodes Scholar. Locke was perhaps the central intellectual of the Harlem Renaissance. By the time he encountered Mason, he had already edited The New Negro, the anthology that announced the movement. In Harlem, as in the Southwest, Mason saw the primitive element still flaming that opposing whites, in order to live at all, will yet have to receive. And by supporting the central figures of the Harlem Renaissance, Mason hoped to orchestrate that reception. She became the single largest sponsor of the movement, counting at one time or another Locke, Hurston, Langston Hughes, Aaron Douglas, Arthur Fawcett, Miguel Covarrubias, and Hall Johnson among her godchildren, end quotes. Mason had difficult relationships with the artists and writers she supported, I wonder why, and fell out at some point with all but Locke. Many, like Langston Hughes, came to resent Mason's assumption that they could be primitive and know and feel the intuitions of the primitive. Hurston, too, felt under pressure to play along with Mason's fantasies. In letters, she signed off as Godmother's Pickaninny, woo, and addressed Mason as dearest little mother of the primitive world, wow, and darling godmother, the guard mother who sits in the 12th heaven and shapes the destinies of the primitives. Wow, Zora Neale Hurston, clowning. The degree to which Hurston bought into her patron's primitivist ideology is difficult to ascertain. After Mason had terminated their relationship, Hurston wrote to a friend, "I have kicked loose from the Park Avenue dragon," but later in her memoir, finally recalled their psychic bond. For a time, Mason had considered Hurston her most important protege. "Zora is the only person, I think, among the Negroes who can receive the flash," she wrote, and her faith in Hurston, as well as its eventual dissipation, had everything to do with Barracoon. By the time she met Mason in September 1927, Hurston had already interviewed Cudjoe Lewis, Casula, under the joint aegis of the Columbia Anthropology Department and the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. Frantz Boas, widely considered the father of American anthropology, had mentored Hurston during her time as a Barnard's first Black student and helped her secure funding for 6 months of postgraduate fieldwork. It was Boas who had first recommended she visit Lewis. Also known as Casula, a shortened version of his African name, Lewis was reputed to be the last surviving victim of the African slave trade, and he was something of a holy grail for anthropologists. His memories had been recorded several times, and some of his folk tales had even appeared in Locke's New Negro anthology. Hurston's first stab at interviewing Lewis had not gone well. It's possible that he had trouble remembering details, he was in his late 80s, that he was tired of repeating his story to anthropologists, or that he simply did not want to repeat it to Hurston. For whatever reason, she seems to have had so much trouble getting material from Lewis that she plagiarized much of her report on the encounter as her first biographer, Robert Hemingway, discovered in the 1970s from Emma Langdon Roach's 1914 pro-slavery account, Historic Sketches of the South. At the time, though, Hurston's account passed for original. It was published as Cudjoe's Own Story of the Last African Slaver in October 1927. Hurston had only been back in New York for a few weeks when she visited Mason's lavish Park Avenue apartment for the first time. She was collaborating on a folk opera with Langston Hughes, and she wanted to pitch Mason on the idea of financing it. "I went to see Mrs. Mason, and I think we got on famously. God, I hope so," she wrote to Hughes. She likes the idea of the opera. Mason, however, had other ideas. Whites generally do. She was looking for someone who could help her see the same thing done by the Negroes as I did with the Indians, a folklorist who could assemble something like the Indians' book and Hurston fit the bill. In December 1927, Mason decided to formalize the arrangement. According to the contract she drew up, Hurston agreed to return to the South as Mason's proxy. In exchange for a monthly stipend, she was to seek out the music, folklore, poetry, voodoo, conjure, manifestations of art, and kindred matters existing among American Negroes, all in quotes. Hurston was legally obligated to lay before Mason whatever material she collected. She was forbidden from publishing or sharing her material, or even from disclosing its subject matter without prior approval from Mason. The opera project was put on indefinite hold, and by the end of the month, Hurston was en route to Mobile to interview Lewis again. This time, Lewis had incentive to comply. It's unclear when or why Mason started paying him, but her letters indicate that she was already in the habit of sending him monthly checks as early as February 1928, Black History Month payment maybe. And when Hurston told Lewis about the nice white lady from New York, she explains in Barracoon, he became willing to divulge some of his most upsetting memories. I'm not going to do this in dialect because I am not the narrator, Robin Miles. I tell you more about Cudjo when he was in Dahomey. He says, referring to his time in captivity, I tell you right, she good to me. You tell her, Cudjo, lack her please. Mason used her sway with Lewis not only to guarantee Hurston. Mason used her sway with Lewis not only to guarantee Hurston's contact, but also to withhold that contact from others. Over a period of months, she and Locke conspired, what a word, conspired to prevent Paul Radin, a prominent anthropologist who had read Hurston's article, from interviewing Lewis. Zora must contrive to seal Cudjo's lips and not let her material get loose, Locke wrote. Mason told Hurston to use the fact that the lady in the North who sends him the money to buy his fruit and tobacco every month would feel badly to have him give any of his African things to any person but a Negro, in quotes. When their plan to blockade Radin proved successful, Locke sent Mason a cryptic telegram. Hawk slides to Mobile tomorrow. Chickens safe. It is impossible to overestimate the value Mason assigned to Cudjo Lewis's story, the book she believed would burn to ashes the white blood that tramps leadening the Negro race in America. She wrote, we must have that human story in letters of fire that enclose and at the same time set aflame the memories of the whole African race. There is no evidence that Hurston shared Mason's obsession with Cudjo Lewis's material. Hurston's letters from the field convey her excitement about much of the folklore she was finding and the various ways she could later stage it or write it up, but only one of those letters so much as mentions Lewis, and it is to contrast him unfavorably with another survivor of the slave trade. She is a better talker than Cudjo, Hurston wrote to Hughes. No one will ever know about her but us, as she did with several people and stories over the course of her Southern fieldwork. Hurston decided to withhold the new subject from Mason, siphoning off some of her best material. Hurston appears to have seen the work she did for Mason, including her interviews with Cudjo Lewis, as distinct from the work she did for herself. She later confessed to Hughes when she found a new project, I am wary of mentioning it to Godmother for fear she will think I am shirking. When Hurston returned from the field, she was eager to get back to her theatrical projects, but she found herself under constant pressure to produce deliverables. I am urged to do things as quickly as possible, she wrote to Boaz. She divided up the content she had collected into three separate book projects. One on folklore, another on conjure, and a third strictly on what Mason called her Casula material, but Hurston's progress was too slow for her patron. Mason was in mortal terror that Cudjo Lewis material would somehow leak before Hurston could write it up. Yet it wasn't until late in the fall of 1930, almost 3 years after she'd interviewed Lewis, that Hurston began drafting the manuscript. Mason's notes for a January 1931 meeting with Hurston alternate between concern about the Casula material, is it in its last form, did she bring it, and racist barbs about Hurston's lack of dedication to the project. This is the reason the whole white world says you can't do anything with Negroes. They are unreliable, in quotes. In letters, Hurston tried to buy more time. Do not despair of me, godmother, she wrote. I shall come through this time. And on April 18, Hurston announced, at last, Barracoon is ready for your eyes. The spring of 1931 was the middle of the Great Depression, hardly a good time to sell any manuscript, let alone an experimental text intended for a popular audience and rendered mostly in a dialect to which that audience was unaccustomed. Harper and Brothers, now HarperCollins, was Mason's first choice, and the legendary NOP editor, Harry Block, who had already given Hurston feedback on a draft of her Conjure book, was also eager to take a look. Block had found the Conjure manuscript too anthropological for a general audience, and he thought the same of Barracoon. He advised Hurston and Mason that only anthropologists have any interest in dialect. Harper's likewise decided they cannot publish it unless she takes it out of dialect, Mason explained to Locke. Dialect was a hallmark of anthropological writing, especially the school of anthropology headed up by Boas, who brought an emphasis on scientific objectivity to the discipline, but it was also a priority for the decidedly unscientific Mason. If black writers were to bring white America into contact with the primitive, she believed they could hardly do so with works in the white man's tongue. For Mason, revising Barracoon into standard English was a non-starter. But Mason was intent on overcoming the egotism of the publishing world, and she enlisted Locke's help. Break the stone heads of these publishers, she implored him, then into the debris heap. Locke had already advocated for the book with both Block and Harper's, and he's also managed to pique the interest of the managing editor at Viking. Forewarned about the book's heavy use of dialect, the Viking editor was still particularly anxious to see her manuscript, Locke told Mason. But Hurston had ignored Viking's request for the manuscript and sent her copy to Locke instead, telling him she was depressed and was going away for a short while in the country. When Locke received Mason's call to arms, he decided not to wait for Hurston to return to the city. He sent the copy directly to the editor at Viking, where Hurston's literary agent tracked it down. What followed was a protracted disillusionment. Over the next year, Mason slowly came to the realization that Hurston had no intention of making the extensive revision her agent had promised. The Viking press again asks for the life of Casula, but in the language rather than dialect. Hurston wrote Mason in the fall of 1931. It lies here, and I know your mind about that, and so I did not answer them except with your tongue. Despite the discouragement, Mason assumed Hurston was working on her new draft. I hope Zora has been able to get the Casula manuscript to you, she wrote Locke in December. Remember, I would like to succeed in my ideal in this matter, depressed times or no. But in March 1932, Locke reported to Mason that Hurston had not revised the Casula material. She was working on stories and theatrical projects instead. You do not seem to realize that I made a contract with you, Mason wrote in a draft of a letter to Hurston. All of 1930, you were supposed to be getting your books ready. She had paid Hurston a monthly allowance with nothing to show for it. By the fall, unhappy with Hurston's continued focus on her theatrical work, Mason had cut her off entirely. She was still sending Cudjoe Lewis his monthly checks. When Hurston did return to her Cudjoe Lewis material in the 1940s, it was briefly, first in a passage in her memoir and then in a short article for American Mercury. But even after that, she had published multiple works celebrating black dialect. She never again tried her hand at Barracoon. In 1973, when Alice Walker tracked down Hurston's unmarked grave, all of her books were out of print. After returning to Florida to find work as a maid, Hurston had died in obscurity, one of many residents of a welfare home in St. Lucie County who hadn't left behind funds to cover the cost of a funeral. Walker bought her a tombstone and inscribed it with the words, "Zora Neale Hurston, a genius of the South, novelist, folklorist, anthropologist." Then she set about making sure Hurston was remembered that way. It goes on to talk about some of the other books. Back to Barracoon. The publication of Barracoon, in fact, represents the latest stage in the project. Walker inaugurated the project of resurrecting Hurston's works. Until now, Cudjoe Lewis's full story and Hurston's first book-length work was withheld from the public. Barracoon was all but erased from the historical record, but it's worth wondering if the price of rectifying that erasure has to be erasing the more difficult parts of Barracoon's context. It's worth asking why almost everyone who has written about Barracoon's publication has felt compelled to sanitize its backstory. What in the zeitgeist has led them to believe that a complicated history would be somehow disqualifying and that they'd be better off ignoring it? Yet, like it or not, Barracoon bears Mason's indelible mark. It was written on her schedule, under her pressure, and with her money. The 2018 edition of the text even opens with the bizarre dedication that Hurston, respecting her patron's insistence on privacy, never included in her typed manuscript. To Charlotte Mason, my godmother, and the one mother of all the primitives, who, with the gods in space, is concerned about the hearts of the untaught. Mason's role in the creation of Barracoon is uncomfortable, but discomfort is a bad reason not to acknowledge the material conditions under which any work, no matter how significant or revered, was shaped. And that's especially true given the discomfort Hurston herself felt about Barracoon. The discomfort that, for whatever reasons and with whatever intentions, led her to walk away from the text and never return. I did not read the entire report, but you heard about 75% of this. Is from LA Review of Books, A Different Backstory for Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon by Rebecca Panovka, Panovka, July 7, 2018. Wow. Context is so, so important. I didn't even share my comments, but I feel like I said a lot. If that was just rambling and people were sitting there like, my God, he's just going to sit here and read this whole boring article on a beautiful summer Friday afternoon. My bad. I thought that was very almost required. Maybe we should have read that before we started reading the book. Better late than never. Any thoughts from what we just heard? I did post it already on Facebook. I'll tweet it, share it again so folks can read the entire report at their leisure. Thank you to the investor who shared the report. What a doozy. Any thoughts on what was shared?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, I know before reading this book, you know, any book that is written after somebody's death, and especially with the fingerprints of Mason, there's highly suspect of, you know, editing by somebody in regards to besides what Zora Neale Hurston had wrote. So there's always suspect of editing when whenever the author, a book is published and the author is, you know, is already passed on. So, no surprise to me. So, that's all I had on me in my life.
Much obliged, sir. Any other folks? I said last week
just on the fact that, and that's researching. When you read, I think reading encourages researching. This book has footnotes. I would encourage anyone, if you have the book, to check out some of the footnotes as we proceed. But I think that's just one of the benefits of reading. It encourages getting additional information. If that's you read another book, or what other books has this author written, or are there other books on this subject matter? It just encourages more additional learning, in my view. In preparing to read this book, the audio clip that we started with today, literary scholar Valerie Boyd, she has written about Barracuda. I'd be curious to know if she knows about this report and all of the details about what we just read, heard. But she does talk about Mason, Catherine Mason, and her racist role in Zora Neale Hurston's life and the conflict. We heard all of that. I think that is so extraordinarily important, especially also if a suspected racist, you are financing not only the non-white author of the book, you're also financing the person who's being interviewed. That's real important in terms of, at least for me, evaluating the accuracy of the book, especially if it's something talking about slavery, racism, to know that a white person is paying a black person to write this book and paying the black person that's being interviewed for this book. Oh, I'll keep that in mind as I read. Pertinent information. Mike, totally change how I feel about the book, getting that information. Any other folks have thoughts on the report that we just read or the book thus far? I still feel like I haven't shared any of my notes, but that's fine as well. Any other folks have comments?
Yes, I just want to say that I thought that that was very informative, and I was under the impression that, you know, any literature or books that was published, you know, like in the 1920s, 1930s, would, you know, have those footprints on it of racist, you know. But this piece, what was unique about it is, like you said in the footnotes, you know, when he describes his village and how the Dahomey tribe raided the village, there's actual historic publications of that raid. So it kind of like, you know, authenticates what he's saying. And it's a very worthwhile piece of work, I think. Thanks, guys.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. I will see if I can get in my thoughts quickly, and then we'll get to audio segment number two. We're picking up on chapter 8 when we get started. If you do not get your hand up in the next few minutes, just make a note, and we will get your commentary once the second audio segment concludes. The general feeling that I had while reading the book came through especially strong today, given so much of what we talked about last week was the enormous focus on Africans, so-called, selling other Africans into slavery. That was a huge part of the focus from last week. It was in the introductions, both of them. It's in the foreword written by Alice Walker. It was in the introductions, and then that was a major focus of what Kasula spoke about this week and last week. I take that, and then at this point, we've read over half of the book, okay? This is a very short book. At this point, we're beyond the halfway point. If we were going to go out and talk, we would be able to go participate easily and competently if someone were going to have a book discussion on this book, because we've already read 60% of it. If you participated last week, first half of this week, most of what we have heard, in my view, has been focused on black culpability. My understanding of the system of racism, white supremacy. If I was talking to Kasula, Mr. Demery Four, Pam, Mr. Edward Williams, Minister Malcolm X, Kunta Kinte, if I was talking to any black person in the last 400 years, 500 years in the Northwestern Hemisphere, if I was talking to them and the narrative that they gave me at any time during that period in talking about their life and times and the struggles that they've had, and the narrative that they gave me, the dominant portion of their problems were focused on, man, black people messed us over and black people did this. Because even when he gets stateside, it's the I took notes. I could just go to my notes. When he gets stateside, he's talking about how the African Americans were not good to him as well. After we've heard about the good Cap'n Jim and the good Cap'n Bill, how well the white slave masters treated him on the boat and didn't whip them too much. We hear about, let's see. Oh, and they didn't put them to work right away when they got on the plantation. They allowed them to sit back and observe. I've never, I can say it now how I really felt as I was I have never heard such madness in my life. Like, enslaved black people, we're going to bring you to the plantation. And I'm going to just read what it said. They don't put us to work right away. I have never heard that. We read Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. Legendary. Right here, context of white supremacy in the archives. I did not hear anything about we were stolen, shackled, and brought to a plantation, and then we sat on the sideline and we watched them pull cotton for a few hours to see how it's done. I have never heard anything that even sounds remotely close to that in my life. When he goes down, after we hear about the Conley slave masters and said, everybody look at us strange because they were dancing. And what have you. And he says, everyone look at us strange. We want to talk with the other colored folks, but they don't know what we say. Some make fun of us. And then he goes on, he's talking about they were dancing on Sunday and the black colored people again made fun of them. That's what, in reading more than half of the text, we've got that black people on the continent were savages and selling them off into slavery and chopping off heads and putting them on spikes like something out of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And we got black people stateside who are cracking jokes and making fun of them and not trying to talk to them and just, you know, look at the dumb African. That's what we got in 60% of the book and mixed in with Conley slave masters who didn't make them work immediately on the plantation and didn't whip them too much on the barracoon. That's what we got through 60% of the book. That right there, I can totally see where a racist white woman would pay a black person to write such material and would pay another black person to interview or at least say that you wrote such material or say that you were interviewed. I could totally 2018, 1918, 1818. I could totally understand that happening and why you would end up with a project like this that I did not enjoy at all. Footnotes or no. Did anyone have other comments? We have about 3 minutes. If Gus is talking crazy, please let me know. Any other comments that folks would like to share, feel free. And again, since we have covered a lot of slave material on the Cows and the Book Club specifically, Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, phenomenal. Medical apartheid, a big chunk of that is about to, I don't remember hearing that in medical apartheid either. Slaves being taken to the plantation and being given an opportunity to just sit and watch, get a little training from the side, and then get the shucking. Any other folks have comments before we get to audio segment number two? I will assume folks are at least good for the time being. Certainly, if what I'm saying does not make sense, if you think, you know, Gus, you're talking crazy, this, you know, sounds sensible. I don't think that there's anything suspicious about, you know, the way the book is written, white people being repeated or white enslavers, white slave masters consistently being referred to as not that bad. That's the sort of thing. I mean, this is the way I would normally sound if a white person or anybody else was talking to me about kindly white slave masters and black people consistently as the villains. I would have the same questions, the same suspicion, the same revulsion if someone were presenting me a narrative that sounded like this under any other circumstances, especially Charlotte Mason's financing of this project. I will end before we get to the second audio segment. I've pointed this out for years. Whites are phenomenal at sitting on material. They had this manuscript for decades. They could have published this whenever they wanted. They've published a lot of Zora Neale Hurston's material. They just said her material was out of print, right? For decades. Oh, we'll go back. We'll put it back into print. Widely available. You can go Amazon, Borders, wherever you need, and easily get a copy of Their Eyes Were Watching God or anything else Zora Neale Hurston wrote, including Barracoon. They could have made this book available years ago. Why wait and publish it now? What's the point of having a text like this available at this point in time, 2018? Something to think about as we proceed. Audio segment number two, we're picking up on chapter 8, freedom, that should be in quotes, under the system of white supremacy. This is Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo. Put an asterisk next to that. Financed by suspected race soldier, the godmother, Catherine Mason. Audio segment number 2.
Chapter 8. Freedom. After they free us, you understand me, we so glad. We make it a drum and beat it like into Africa, so. My countrymen come from Captain Burns' Mayor Plantation where we is in the magazine point, so we be together. We glad we free. But then you understand me, we can't stay with the folks what own us no more. Therefore, where we gonna live, we don't know. Some the folks from across the water, they done married and got the wife and children, you understand me? Cudjo not married yet. Into Africa, so when the man got it a wife, he build a house so they live together and therefore the children come. So we want build it a house as for ourselves, but we ain't got no land. Where we going build it our houses? We meet together and we talk. We say we from across the water, so we go back where we come from. So we say we work in slavery 5 years and 6 months for nothing. Now we work for money and get in the ship and go back to our country. We think Captain Mayer and Captain Foster, they ought to take us back home. But we think we save money and buy the ticket ourselves. So we tell the women, now we all want to go back home. Somebody tell us it take a lot of money to carry us back into Africa, so. Therefore, we got to work hard and save the money. You must help, too. You see fine clothes, you must not wish for them. The women tell us they do all they can to get back in their country. And they tell us, you see fine clothes, don't you wish for them neither. We work hard and try to save our money. But it too much money we need. So we think we stay here. We see we ain't got no ruler, nobody to be the father to the rest. We ain't got no king neither, no chief like in Africa. We don't try to get no king because nobody among us ain't born no king. They tell us nobody don't have no king in America, so. Therefore, we make Gumpa the head. He a nobleman back in Dahomey. We ain't mad with him, because the king of Dahomey destroy our king and sell us to the white man. He didn't do nothing against us. Therefore, we join ourselves together to live. But we say, we ain't in the Africa soil no more. We ain't got in no land. Therefore, we talk together, so we say, they bring us away from our soul and work it as hard as 5 years and 6 months. We go to Captain Tim and Captain Jim, and they give us the land, so we make it houses for ourselves. They say, Cudjo, you always talk it good, so you go tell the white man and tell it them what the Africans say. All the Africans, we work it hard. We get it work in the sawmill and the power mill. Some us work for the railroad. The women work too, so they can help us. They don't work for the white folks. They raise it a garden and put it a basket on the head and go into Mobile and sell the vegetable. We make it a basket, and the women sell it them too. Therefore, you understand me, it one day not long after, they tell me to speak for land so we build it our houses. Cudjo cutting timber for the mill. It a place where the schoolhouse at now. Captain Tim Mayer come sit on the tree Cudjo just chop it down. I say, now is the time for Cudjo to speak for his people. We want land so much I almost cry. And therefore I stop at work and look here, Captain Tim. He sat on the tree chopping splinters with his pocket knife. When he don't hear the axe on the tree no more, he look up and see Cudjo standing there. Therefore he asked me, Cudjo, what make you so sad? I tell him, Captain Tim, I grieve for my home. He say, But you got a good home, Cudjo. Cudjo say, Captain Tim. How big is the mobile? I don't know, Cudjo. I've never been to the Four Corners. Well, if you give Cudjo all the mobile, that railroad and all the banks, Cudjo don't want it because it ain't home. Captain Tim, you brought us from our country where we had land. You made us slave. Now they make us free, but we ain't got no country and we ain't got no land. Why don't you give us peace this land so we can build ourselves a home? Captain jump on his feet and say, Fool, do you think I gonna give you property on top of property? I took a good care of my slaves in slavery, and therefore I don't owe them nothing. You don't belong to me now. Why must I give you my land? Cudjo tell Gumpa, call the people together, and he tell them what Captain Tim say. They say, well, we buy ourselves a piece of land. We work it hard and save, and eat molassing bread, and buy the land from the mayor. They don't take off 1 5-cent from the price for us, but we pay it all and take the land. We make Gumpa the head, and J.B. and Kibi the judges. Footnote. Gumpa is African for Peter. End of footnote. Then we make laws how to behave ourselves. When anybody do wrong, we make him appear before the judges, and they tell him he got to stop doing like that because it don't look nice. We don't want nobody to steal, neither get it drunk, neither hurting nobody. When we see a man drunk, we say, there go the slave what beat his master. That mean he buy the whiskey. It belong to him, and he ought to rule it, but it don't got control of him. Now that's right, ain't it? When we speak to a man what do wrong, the next time he do that, we whip him. Therefore, we builded the houses on the land we buy after we vied it up. Cudjo take 1 acre and a half for his part. We don't pay nobody build our houses. We all go together and builded the house for one another. So then we get the houses. Cudjo don't build no house at first because he ain't got no wife. We call our village African Town. We say that because we want to go back into Africa soil. And we see we can't go. Therefore, we make it to Africa where they fetch us. Gumpa say, my folks sell me, and your folks, Americans, buy me. We here, and we got to stay. Free George come help us all the time. The colored folks what born here, they pick at us all the time and call us ignorant savage. But Free George, the best friend the Africans got, he tell us we ought to get it to religion and join the church. But we don't want to be mixy with the other folks what laugh at us. So we say we got plenty land, and therefore we can build our own church. Therefore we go together and build the old landmark Baptist church. It the first one round here. Cudjo dismissed me by saying abruptly, when you come tomorrow, I like you take me down the bay so we get us some crab. Chapter 9. Marriage. He had on his battered hat when I drove up the next day. His rude walking stick was leaning against the door jamb. He picked it up and came on out to the car at once, and we drove off. Without the last prompting, he began to talk about his marriage. Abila? She a woman, you understand me, from across the water. They call her silly in American soil. I want this woman to be my wife. She ain't married, you understand me, and I ain't got no wife yet. All the folks from my country, they got family. What did Cudjo say so that this woman know he want to marry her? I tell you that. I tell you the truth how it was. One day Cudjo say to her, I like you to be my wife. I ain't got nobody. She say, what you want with me? I want to marry you. You think if I be your wife, you can take care of me? Yeah, I can work for you. I ain't going to beat you. I didn't say no more. We got married 1 month after we agreed between ourselves. We didn't have no wedding. Whether it was March or Christmas Day, I don't remember now. Therefore, you know, we live together, and we do all we can to make happiness between ourselves. Therefore, you understand me, after me and my wife agreed between ourselves, we seek a religion and got converted. Then in the church, they tell us that ain't right. We got to marry by license. In the advocate's so you understand me, we ain't got no license. The man and the woman, they agreed between themselves. Then they married and lived together. We don't know nothing about they have license over here in this place. So then we get married by the license. But I don't love my wife no more with the license than I love her for the license. She a good woman, and I love her all the time. Me and my wife, we have 6 children together, 5 boys and 1 girl. Oh, Lord, we so happy. Poor Cudjo. All the folks done left him now. That's so lonely. We've been married 10 months when we have our first baby. We call him Yajimmy. Just the same like we was in the Africa soil. For America, we call him Alec. In the Africa, we got it one name. But in this place, they tell us we needed 2 names. One for the son, you understand me, and then one for the father. Therefore, I put the name of my father, Olulue, to my name. But it too long for the people to call it. It too crooked, like Kazula. So they call me Cudjo Lewis. So you understand me? We give our children 2 names. One name because we not forget our home. Then another name for the American soil, so it won't be too crooked to call. The next child, we name him Anonoto. Then we call him Jimmy. The next one named Polidau. He a boy, too. Then we have Atenia, and we call him David. The last boy, we call him my name, Kudjo. But his African name, it Fishiton. Then my wife have 1 little girl, and we call her Ibu Osi. Then we call her Sili, after her mama. All the time the children growing up, the American folks, they picks at them and tell the African people they kill folks and eat the meat. They call him my children ignorant savage and make out they kin to monkey. Therefore, you understand me, my boys, they fight. They got to fight all the time. Me and their mama don't like to hear our children call savage. It hurted their feelings. Therefore, they fight hard. When they whip the other boys, they folks come to our house and tell us, yo, boys mighty bad, Cudjo. We afraid they gonna kill somebody. Cudjo meeted the people at the gate and tell them, you see the rattlesnake in the woods? They say, yeah. I say, if you bother with him, he bite you. If you know the snake killing you, why you bother with him? Same way with my boys, you understand me? If you leaving my boys alone, they not bother nobody. But they keep on, all the time. Alec this, Jimmy that, Polly this and t'other. David a bad boy. Cudjo fighty my son. Nobody never say what they do to the African savages. They say he ain't no Christian. They tell what the savages do to them, just like we ain't got enough feelings to get hurt. We Africans try raise our children right. When they say we ignorant, we go together and build the schoolhouse. Then the county send us a teacher. We African men don't wait like the other colored people till the white folks get it ready to build us a school. We build one for ourselves, then ask the county to send us to teacher. Oh, Lord, I love my children so much. I try so hard to be good to our children. My baby, Celie, the only girl I got, she took his sick into bed. Oh, Lord, I'd do anything to save her. We get it the doctor. We get it all the medicine he tell us to get. Oh, Lord, I pray, I tell the Lord I'd do anything to save my baby life. She ain't but 15 year old, but she die. Oh, Lord, look on the gravestone and see what it say. August the 5th, 1893. She born 1878. She don't have no time to live before she die. Her mama take it so hard. I tried telling her not to cry, but I cried too. That the first time in the American soil that death find where my door is. But we from cross the water know that he come in the ship with us. Therefore, when we build it, our church, we buy the ground to bury ourselves. It on the hill, facing the church door. We Christian people now. So we put our baby in the coffin, and they take her in the church, and everybody come look down in her face. They sing, "Shall we meet beyond the river?" I've been a member of the church a long time now, and I know the words of the song with my mouth, but my heart, it don't know that. Therefore, I sing inside me. O todo o wa, en lo yali, o uran, kanira ra, kaniro ro. We bury her there in the family plot. She looking so lonesome out there by herself. She's such a little girl, you understand me, that I hurry and build a fence round the grave so she have protection. 9 years we heard it inside about our baby. Then we get heard it again. Somebody call himself a deputy sheriff killed a baby boy now. He say he the law, but he don't come resting. If my boy done something wrong, it his place come rest him like a man. If he mad with my cudjo about something, then he ought to come fight him face to face like a man. He don't come rest him like no sheriff, and he don't come fight him like no man. He have words with my boy, but he scared face him. Therefore, you understand me, he hide himself in the butcher wagon. And when it get it to my boy's store, Cudjo walked straight to talk business. This man, he hiding himself in the back of the wagon and shooting my boy. Oh, Lord. He shooting my boy in the throat. He got no right shooting my boy. He make out he scared my boy going to shoot him and shooting my boy down in the store. Oh, Lord. The people run, come telling me my boy hurt it. We took him home and lay him in the bed. The big hole in the neck. He tried so hard to catch his breath. Oh, Lord, it hurted me see my baby boy like that. It hurted his mama so her breast swell up so. It make me cry 'cause it hurt Celie so much. She keeps standing at the foot of the bed, you understand me, and looking all the time in his face. She keep telling him all the time, "Cudjo, cudjo, cudjo, baby, put whip to your horse." He hurt it so hard, but he answer her the best he can, you understand me. He tell her, "Mama, that's what I've been doing." 2 days and two nights my boy lay in the bed with the noise in the throat. His mama never leave him. She look at his face and tell him, "Put whip to your horse, baby." He pray all he could. His mama pray. I pray so hard. But he died. I so sad I wish I could die in place of my cudgel. Maybe I don't pray right, you understand me? Because he died while I was praying that the Lord spare my boy life. The man that killed my boy, he the pastor of Hay Chapel in Plateau today. I try to forgive him. But could you think that now he got religion, he ought to come and let me know his heart done change and beg Cudjo pardon for killing my son. It only 9 years since my girl died. Look like I still hear the bell toll for her when it toll again for my fishito. My poor African boy that don't never see Africa so.
Chapter 10. Kuzula learns about law.
They don't do nothing to the man what kill him, my son. He a deputy sheriff. I don't do nothing. I a Christian man then. I a sick man too. I done get hurty by the train, you understand me? Cudjo tell you how he get hurty. I tell you just like it were. Cudjo, don't forget it. It in March, you understand me, and I make it a God. It the 12th day of March, 1902. It a woman called me, you understand me, to plow the field for. She say, Cudjo, I like to get you plow the garden so I can plant the sweet potatoes. I'll pay you. I agree to that. Therefore, you understand me, I get it up early the next morning and go plow the garden for her. So then, when I get through with hers, I can plant my garden. I don't finish her garden, because my wife, she calling me and scold me. She telling me, Cudjo, why you go work it hard like that for you eat your breakfast? That ain't right. You gonna be sick. I got your breakfast ready long time. You come eat. I go home with Celia and eat the breakfast. Then I think it going rain. So I said I plant my beans. Therefore, you understand me, I tell my wife, come to the field with me and help me plant the beans. She say, Cudjo, why you want me in the field? I can't plant no beans. I tell her, come on and drop the beans while I held them up. She come with me and I show her how. After a while, she say, Cudjo, you don't need me drop no beans. You can't work without no woman round you. You bringing me here for company. I say that's right. We ain't got enough beans. So I went to the market and asked the man for early beans, but he ain't got none. Therefore, you understand me, I get him my wife some meat and come home. Then I feed him a horse and my wife, she cooking. So then I curry the horse in a sprinkle rain. I stop it and study. I don't know if I go get him more beans in the mobile or if I wait. I said to go fetch the beans. Therefore, I asked my wife to give me money. She put $3 on the mantelpiece. I asked her, silly, why you give me so much money? I don't need no $3. She say, spend what you need and bring it the rest back. I know you ain't gonna waste the money. Then I hitch up the horse and go into Mobile to get it the beans. Soon as I get the beans, I turn back to go home. When I reach here, the government street and common, it to Ellen and railroad track there, you understand me? When I approach the track, another rig going very slow in the middle of the road. So I make the pass at the rig, and just when I pass it and get out on the track, the train rush it down on me. Oh, Lord. I holler to them to stop, cause I dare on the track, but they don't stop. It a switch engine, you understand me? It rush it on and hit it the buggy and knock me and hurt in my left side. Oh, Lord. The horse get it scared and run away. My boy David find him next day and fetch him home. Somebody see the train hit me and hear me holler for them to stop. They come picking me up and carry me to the doctor office. He give me the morphine. A white lady on Government Street see me all hurty, and she see that I took care of. When I go home, she send me a basket and visit me. She say the railroad ain't got no right smash up the buggy and hurting me. I in the bed 14 days. They broke 3 ribs. They ain't rung no bell. They ain't blow no whistle. She say she gon' see the company. Therefore she go in the office of the L&N. The man in there telling her, we ain't going to do nothing. It was daytime. Can't he see? When I get able to get round, the lady telling me, get me a lawyer, and he make it a company pay me for hurting me and destroy the buggy. Therefore, I go in the office of Lawyer Clark. He a big lawyer. Could you tell him I ain't able to hire you? I want you to go to the company. I give you half. The lawyer sued the company. The next year, 1903, in January, they send for me to appear in court. The judge say, the first case this morning is Cudjoe Lewis against the L&N for $5,000. I look it hard. I say to myself, who tell him that? I didn't tell him I want $5,000. The railroad lawyer say, we ain't going to give him nothing. Well, Lawyer Clark talk too. He say, I all heard it. I never be able to work no more. They pull off my short and look it at the left side, and the doctor say no, because you can't work no more. Then Lawyer Clark say, the railroad ought to take care of me, done crippling me so bad. The railroad lawyer say, they not going to give me nothing. They say it broad daylight. Ain't this cudgel got no eyes to see the great big train? Lawyer Clark say, the train got a bell, but they didn't ring it. They got a whistle, but they didn't blow it. The railroad track it laying right across the road. How can the city of Mobile let it, the company, make it the street dangerous and don't make it in pay when people get hurty on their track? He talk a long time. Then we all go out to courthouse to eat at the dinner. I tired, so I think I go home. I go get us some flesh in the market to take home to Celie. David, he stay in the court. He know the market I like, and therefore he run kitchen me in the market before I go home and tell me, Papa, the judge give you $650 from the company. The lawyers say you come tomorrow and get your money. I don't go next day, but I send David. The lawyers say, that too soon, come back next week. Well, I send and I send, but Cudjoe don't get in no money. In the 1904, the yellow fever come into Mobile, and Lawyer Clark take his wife and children and get on the train to run into New York away from the fever. But he never get it in the north. He die on the way. Cudjoe never know what come of the money. It always a hidden mystery how come I not killed when the train is standing over me. I thank God I alive today. The people see I ain't able to work no more, so they make me the sexton of the church.
Chapter 11. Cudjoe's friends down the bay caught us a marvelous mess of blue crabs. We left these people late in the afternoon with many lingering exchanges of good wishes. On the way home, we saw some excellent late melons in front of a store and bought 2 of them. I left one melon on his porch and took the other with me. At the gate, he called after me, you come tomorrow and eat a crab with me. I like you, come keep me company. So the next day, about noon, I was sitting on the steps between the rain barrels eating crabs. When the crabs were gone, we talked.
Let Cudjoe tell you about our boy David. He's such a good boy. Cudjoe don't forget that day. It Easter Saturday. He come home, you understand me, and find me sweeping the church. I been a sexton long time then. So he asked me, Papa, where Mama? I tell him, she in the house. Therefore, he go in the house, you understand me, and ask his mama what she gonna have for dinner. She tell him she got the baked fish. He say, oh, I so glad we got baked fish. Give me my dinner quick. His mama asked him, when did you ever see me give you anything to eat before your pa? He say, never. She say, you take your back then. Maybe that time your pa here to eat his dinner. The boy running back out to me and tell me make haste so we get something to eat. He hungry. I chop it wood. So he take the axe and chop it wood hisself. I say, go on, son, I ain't weak yet. I can chop this wood. He say, no, I don't want you chop wood, and I right here and strong. Therefore, he chop it wood and carry it in the house where his ma can reach it. Then we eat our dinner, and David wash it hisself, and his mama put out the clean clothes for him to put on. He got on the honor shirt, but he ain't got on the top shirt. He ain't got no button on the honor shirt, so me and his ma see the flesh. So I say, son, fasten your clothes so your mama don't see the skin. He look at himself. Then he asked me, who first saw me naked? Mama. Then he laugh and put on the rest of the clothes. He say, Papa, Mama, I go in the mobile and get it the laundry. Then I have clean shirts. I asked him, how long before you come from town? He say, not long. Maybe I catch you the same car back. So he go leave the house. After a while, we hear somebody that come laughing and talking. Celia say, David got a friend with him. I look it to see who David got with him, but it ain't David. Two men come tell me, Uncle Cudjo, your boy dead in Plateau. I say, my boy not in Plateau. He in the mobile. They say, no, the train kill your boy in Plateau. I tell them, how can the train kill my David in Plateau when he not there? He gone in the mobile to get his laundry. He be back after a while. Celia say, go see, Cudjo. Maybe it not our boy. Go see who get killed. Then I asked the men, where that man get killed you telling me about? They say, on the railroad track in Plateau. Therefore, you understand me, I go follow the people. Then I get it to the place where the big crowd stand round looking. I go through the crowd and looking. I see the body of a man by the telegraph pole. It ain't got no head. Somebody tell me that's your boy, Uncle Cudjo. I say, no, it not my David. He lay there by the cross ties. One woman, she faced me and asked the Cudjo, which son of yours is this? And she pointed at the body. I tell her, this none of my son. My boy go in town, and y'all tell me my boy did. One African man come and say, Cudjo, that's your boy. I asked him, is it? If that my boy, where his head? He showed me the head. It on the other side the track. Then he lead me home. Somebody asked me, Cudjo, your boy did. Must I toll the bell for you? You the sexton. You tolled the bell for everybody else. You want me toll it for David? I asked him, why you want to toll the bell for David? He ain't dead. The African man told the people pick up the body and carry it home. So they took the window shutter and laid the body on it and fetch it to Cudjo's gate. The gate it too small, so they lift it over the gate and place it on the porch. I so worried. I wish it so bad my David come back from town so the people stop saying that my son owned the shutter. When they placed the shutter on the porch, my wife, she scream and fall out. The African man say again, Cudjo, that's your boy. I say, if that's my son, tell me where the head. They brung it in a box and I look it down in David's face. Then I say to the crowd, get off my porch. Get out my yard. They went. Then I fell down and opened the shirt and pushing my hand in the bosom and feel the marks. And I know it, my son. I tell them, told the bell. My wife look at my face and she scream and scream and fell on the floor and can't raise herself up. I run it out the place and fell on my face in a pine grove. Oh, Lord. I stay there. I hurt it so. It hurted me so to hear silly cry. Those who had come across the water come to me. They say, Uncle Cacho, come home. Your wife won't you. I say, tell Celia don't holler no more. I can't stand it. She promised me she won't holler if I come home. So I got back to the house. I asked it a friend where they head. He say, they're yonder in the cracker box. I tell him, I want you to put it there on the neck and fasten it so that when people come in the morning, they won't know. My friend, he fastened the head so it don't look like it cut off. Therefore, next day when people come looking in his face, he looked just like he sleep. The bell toll again. Our house is very sad. Looking like all the family hurried to leave and go sleep on the hill. Polly very mad because the railroad killed his brother. He want me to sue the company. I asked him, what for? We don't know the white folks' law. They say they don't pay you when they hurt you. The court say they got to pay you the money, but they ain't done it. You're very sad. Polly very mad. He say the deputy killed his baby brother. Then a train killed David. He want to do something. But I ain't hold no malice. The Bible say not. Police say in African soil it ain't like in the America. He ain't been in the Africa, you understand me, but he hear what we tell him and he think that better than where he at. Me and his mama try to talk to him and make him satisfied, but he don't want hear nothing. He say when he a boy, the American Negro children fight him and say he a savage. When he get a man, they cheat him. The train hurt his papa and don't pay him. His brothers get it killed. He don't laugh no more. Well, after a while, you understand me, one day he say he go catch some fish. Somebody see him go towards the 12-mile creek. Lord, Lord, he never come back. There was a muted, mournful pause, in which I could do nothing but wait with my eyes in the chinaberry tree, lest I appear indecently intrusive. Finally, he came back to me. Excuse me. I can't help it, I cried. A lonesome for my boy. Cudjo know they don't do in the American soil like they do cross the water. But I can't help that. My boy gone. He ain't in the house, and he ain't on the hill with his mama. We both miss him. I don't know. Maybe they killed my boy. It a hidden mystery. So many the folks, they hate my boy because he like his brothers. They don't let nobody abuse them like they dogs. Maybe he in the Africa saw her like somebody say. Go Cudjo lonesome for him. But Cudjo don't know. I try be very nice to Celie. She the mama, you understand me, and therefore you know she grieves so hard about her children. I always try to please her, you understand me, but when we ain't got but two are chillin' with us. I can't stand see her look so like she won't cry all the time. We ain't got but one child in the house with us. 'Cause Alec, the oldest one, you understand me, he married and lived with his wife. We builded him a house right in the yard, just like in the Africa. Or. Look like we ain't crying, or we ain't through crying. End of November, our Jimmy come home and sit round like he don't feel good, so I asked him, son, you get sick? I don't want you running to work when you don't feel good. He say, Papa, tain't nothing wrong with me. I don't feel so good. But the next day, he come home sick and we put him into bed. I do all I can and his mama stay up with him all night long. We get at the doctor and do what he say, but our boy die. Oh, Lord, I good to my children. I want they company, but look it like they lonesome for one another. So they hurry go sleep together in the graveyard. He died holding my hand. When we get it back from the funeral, tain't nobody in the house but me and Celie. The house was full, but now it empty. We old folks now, and we know we ain't gonna have no more children. We so lonesome. But we know we can't get it back to dead. When they spit goes from their mouth, it don't come back. When the earth eats, it don't give back. So we try to keep one another company and be happy. I still sexton at a church. It growing to be a big church now. We call it the Old Landmark Baptist Church, 'cause it's the first one in Africa Town. They done build more Baptist churches now, but ours it the first. My wife, she helped me all she can. She don't let me strain myself, so I hurt at the side where the train hitting me. One day we plant, the next day we reap, so we go on. Before I left, I had Kazula's permission to photograph him, but he forbade my coming back within 3 days. A cow had broken in his fence and was eating his potato vines. It was on a hot Saturday afternoon that I came to photograph Kazula. I'm glad you taking my picture. I won't see how I look. Once long time ago, somebody come take my picture, but they never give me one. You give me one. I agreed. He went inside to dress for the picture. When he came out, I saw that he had put on his best suit, but removed his shoes. I want to look like I in Africa, 'cause that where I want to be, he explained. He also asked to be photographed in the cemetery, among the graves of his family.
Context of white supremacy, we are almost done. We will have a very short segment, and then we will be finished. Gus T, we were back to normal program time today, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Didn't seem like it threw too many people off. Teacher training is almost done. I do not have class today. That's why we were able to return to normal time. Next week at this time, I will be doing my teacher training exam, the yoga class that I have invited Cal's listeners to come participate in. If you have your counter racist t-shirt, is at this time next week. So I'm trying to decide, because it's so short that it's something that we could do early. We could even do it the day before or whatever, because it is a very short segment, and we will be all done. It will not be two audio segments whenever the next segment is for next week. At any rate, it will not be at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific for next Friday. However, once this book is done, when we start the fresh new book, back to normal program time, and I'll be a certified yoga instructor, provided everything goes well next week. Anyway, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-POUND. press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have thoughts from the first audio segment, second audio segment, from the report that we read that gave additional information about suspected race soldier Charlotte Mason, the godmother, and her involvement in this text, would love to hear your commentary. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. We'll start with people that we've not heard from at all. Let's see. 7656, did you have commentary, ma'am? Line should be open.
Hello, thank you so much for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can have. Ooh, that was a lot. I don't know if I can... The resilience of this man is unbelievable. Your kids have... That's a lot. But I do want to comment on some of the other things you talked about in the first segment. I just think, just in general, the access white people have to us and our information, because that young lady, I'm thinking she's a young lady who wrote that article in the LA Review. This is like something she wrote on the side. She's studying history and film. I will give her 26, but I doubt it, because she was just a senior at Harvard 2 years ago. So I will give her the age of 26. And, like, this is not her area, yet she found a way to find time to access this information that seemed primarily to be in Howard or Historically Black College, just the way they have access to information that we wouldn't even think to look for. That's, you know, mind-blowing in and of itself. And the narrator, I looked up the narrator, Ms. Miles. I guess she's a few books, and one of them, it would be interesting to me if you could interview people like the narrators on their choices, because she has awards, and she narrated that Warmth of Other Suns, which is also a narrative, you know, from Black people's perspective, as opposed to the lady who narrated, you know, the New American Classic, and some other popular books that were turned into motion pictures, such as Precious and The Help. I think that would be interesting.
Oh, was that it? Did you have anything else?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was a lot. I can't even comment on what that man, what he's been through. Oh, and I thought it was wonderful that he wanted to keep, you know, still hold on to his African heritage, you know, throughout, then not want to let that go. I think that's wonderful.
For sure. The New American Classic. That is interesting. I would be intrigued to hear, you know, as you were saying, like the choices, as I said, we have heard from Robin Miles before. Which books she picks, which ones she turns down. And some of the, we've heard, you know, quite a few narrators over the years. That would be interesting. I had never thought about that. Much obliged. Let's see. Other folk. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Let's see. The person. Woo! Person that dialed in. I guess you're on the vote line. Did you have commentary? Line should be open.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Volume is a little low. If you could give us a little more volume, please. Or speak, get closer to your microphone, either or.
Is this better?
Give us a few more sentences. Let's see.
Okay, is this better?
That should work. That should work.
I'm finding this book excruciatingly painful, and I can't imagine, well, I guess that's not accurate. I can't imagine that the reason that this book was published at this time is just to continue the full court press pressure and pain and terrorism so that we just never get a break. The book was published, I don't know by whom, but it's very timely in terms of the current conditions that Black people, pressure that we're under, and it's just ongoing. And so this book, it's just like we can talk about the period, but it's happening now. The conditioning of religion in terms of what we really feel when we're attacked in this manner, repeatedly, our children being murdered, etc., repeatedly, is what we're also is rage. And but we always have Christianity that we are pre-programmed into to anesthetize us. And what we really feel is rage. And, you know, and really inflict retribution for it. This is just real. So the book itself, I mean, Cujo, where does he go with all this pain? Zora Neale Hurston and the white supremacist terrorist that was her quote-unquote godmother. And the quote, let me just say this, the freedom, quote-unquote freedom chapter, that's a joke. No land, no money, no justice, no home, and et cetera. So these chapters, you know, these Kasula learns about the law. How? By his son being murdered and no justice from their attorney who runs off with the money? I am just exacerbating to me. I'm not sure what the next book will be, but I probably have to break from if it's anything along the same lines. I mean, so, you know, that's my comments.
Dang. Much obliged. Much obliged. Exacerbated. Let's see. I'm trying to make sure I nab all of the people that we did not hear from first time around. The caller at 0639. Did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hi, Jeff. This is my first time calling in. I want to thank you for the work that you do. I have just been, immersed in your work that you put up on YouTube, and I've learned so much. I wanted to comment about the section prior to this one. I didn't get in until 8:28, and like the previous caller expressed, I found myself experiencing extreme discomfort when I was listening to the description of, you know, the people being led out at the Dahomey part, and I had to force myself. I literally wanted to hang up the phone, but I said no, because this is important for us to, you know, to expose ourselves to this kind of information. I understand the importance. And the second comment I wanted to make was about the part that you shared with us about the report about Charlotte Mason. And you were saying, well, I don't know. Somebody tell me. Am I talking crazy? What? No, because before you read that report, things stuck out at me also that seemed very odd. Like, for instance, the description of the different rivers that she was talking about when they were going up and down these different rivers. And I thought, what, you know, my goodness, you know, what time frame was this? And how did she know so, you know, distinctly about these rivers? And the other part was, which has come up a couple of times, about these colored people. But I noticed it's glossed over. Well, who are these colored people and why isn't there anything said about them? So that prompted me to get up and Google the time frame. I agree with the previous caller also. I wrote a note about the part. Now, in the second section of the audio, no country and no land, and my thoughts were the same as the previous caller, like, well, we're still in the same situation. And I thought also it was interesting, the part where she said that, I forget who it was that was dealing with her, but he said, I don't owe them nothing. And I thought, that sounds like suspected racist input. I don't know. That was just my thought. I guess that's all I wrote some more notes, but that's pretty much, I know that's kind of skipping here and there, but those are just things that stuck out at me, you know.
Spectacular. Thank you so much for sharing. First time caller. Hope it was or has been constructive. Your participation, always great when people decide they're not going to spectate, going to participate. That is always grand. Let's see. I think. Oh, the codified software developer in Wisconsin. Good to hear from you. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers and listeners on the line. So I have the book, and I've been reading along. A couple of things. Just like the previous caller, I had a very difficult time with the Dahomey portion. I'd actually had to put the book down. So it's incredible, just incredibly disturbing. And just for this man to have seen that firsthand is horrifying. I wanted to comment on some stuff from last week. I was listening, and I didn't hear Alice Walker's foreword, which I thought was really interesting. And as you stated before, the plagiarism portion was not in the introduction. I believe that was Deborah Plant who did the introduction, or the first introduction. The second, of course, was Ms. Hurston herself. So I thought that was really interesting. I thought about it, and I said, based on the people that I know, and I know a lot of Black people, like the people that I know, most of them would be more likely to listen to a book rather than read the book. We've been conditioned not to read, of course. And I just, the impression that that would leave on people who are just listening and not reading the book, it would incriminate, for lack of a better term, but that's probably not the correct word that I want to use, Ms. Hurston's scholarship, which is actually pretty amazing. I've been reading the note as well as reading the book, and I've been very impressed with her scholarship. So it's unfortunate that, you know, there were these sort of accusations of plagiarism, because that really detracts from the work that she did. Also, just wanted to talk briefly about why this book would be published now. You know, it seems like there's been a push, and I've been noticing this from some other news outlets and some other people who are sort of in this scope of Black consciousness. There's been a push to talk about how descendants of enslaved Africans here should not be should not be friendly, should not be allied with those who are immigrating here from the continent because they sold our ancestors. And so this seems to be just another tactic for racists to cause some confusion and, for lack of a better term, start some mess. So that has been really that's been really on my mind, actually. But I missed the first segment, and I didn't read that much further beyond the Dahomey, so I'll just mute my line and come back next week. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, all our Wisconsin peeps. Let's see. I think we got all the folks who we have not heard from, didn't hear from the first time around. Mr. Demery 4, we had one more caller as well. Your lines should be open as well if you had commentary. Proceed.
Yes, my beers.
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery 4.
Okay. You know, the last part, I thought that one chapter when he was losing his sons and the suffering that he was, you know, I think they titled it The Law. I thought that it should probably be No Justice. You know, I mean, he was injured in a train accident. And, you know, it just seemed like, you know, everything was going against him. He had a lawyer, but in a lawyer, I guess, flaked out on him. And you know, and then later when his son was killed in a train accident, you know, should have been some compensation there, but the lack of education and then any support, and then the system, the way it's designed, someone may have collected, you know, some monies or funds on those accidents, and he never knew anything about it. And his entire life just been being used from time to time, but he had gotten some joy, you know, with his family through his wife and his kids. He, I think, founded that church and I guess Africatown, I think he's, you know, been given credit for, you know, I think one of the founding members. So there's some significance in his life. It's very painful. I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. Thanks, God.
Indeed, Mr. Demery Four. Hope your wife has fully recovered. Any folks that we missed, anybody who has a hand up, have commentary that they wanted to share that we have not heard from at all? We nabbed everyone. Grant. All right. I will get to my comments. If you think you have a question or thoughts that you want to share, you should get your hand up immediately because we are almost at the conclusion. And I do not know. Lashes suggested a book on economics that certainly would not be anything like this. So I'll have to double check. But I was not anticipating that I would have to be selecting a new book so quickly. So we'll have to see what the next book will read. Before we get to that, let's see, from this week, the second section, I too thought that the chapter 8 being titled Freedom was hypocrisy, the contradictions, however you want to phrase it. I thought there were so many moments where there are conflict, promoting conflict. That's what Charlotte Mason was all about, promoting conflict between Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. Promoting racism, white supremacy. There are so many moments where, in my view, these are just little jabs, conflict between black people born in the States and black people born in the continent, all victims of racism, white supremacy. And I'm not, you know, trying to even give the impression that this conflict is not, you know, legitimate under the system of white supremacy. Non-white people are in conflict with each other all the time. It just depends on which perspective you want to view. You have people all over the continent in conflict with each other. You have black people right here in the States in conflict with each other. It just depends, you know, how you want to view all of the conflict within the context of white supremacy. But he says, we worked hard and saved our money. And they said that they did not want fine clothes. We wanted to save our money to get out of here. I thought that was great. Counter-racist economics. I thought the kindly slave master, I thought we had that pop up again when the slave master tells them to go ahead and eat the hams as opposed to starving and being in a tough spot. Let's see. The portion where he talks about this is after so-called emancipation, and they're talking about alcohol, seeing that they made their own rules once they were quote-unquote emancipated. They began to establish their own code of how they were going to behave, and they were against alcohol. Grand, somebody else endorses that. And they say, when we speak to a man who do wrong, next time he do that, we whip him. That, to me, sounds like slave logic. I hear that sort of logic all the time, particularly in reference to other black people. Them doing something wrong, if they're in some sort of tragic arrangement, they should be beaten. They should be whipped. I hear that all the time, you know, to get them. That's what we need to do to correct behavior of black people. They need a good whipping. That just sounds like slave logic to me. Let's see. I think it's interesting that it seems like one of the only times where there is constructive relationship with a black person born in the States. It's Free George, who is basically functioning as a missionary for the religion of white supremacy under the guise of Christianity. He mentions before Free George was the only one who would not come and call him a savage and laugh at him and mentioned about the good book. And then this time around, he says Free George, he would come help them all the time. The colored folks were born here. They pick at us all the time and call us ignorant savages. But Free George, the best African, the best friend the Africans got, he tell us we ought to get the religion and join the church, religion of white supremacy. Let's see. Next. Chapter 9. Again, lots of jabs. I think Charlotte Mason, that's who the dedication to the book is. She financed this project. He says all the time, the children growing the American folks, they picks at them and tell the African people they kill folks and eat the meat. They call my children ignorant savages and make them out to be monkeys. This is black people teasing. And again, they just opened that museum. The museum to the history of lynching in Alabama, Brian Stevenson's project. They just opened that up, right? They had all that hoopla and talking about all of that in Alabama, where a lot of black people were lynched. Bombingham, they called it, the four little girls, church bombing, 1963. Lots of incidents. Birmingham bus boycott, Scottsboro boys. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about the state of Alabama. How in the world can a black person living in Alabama in the 1920s and someone comes to talk to you about your problems in life and the bulk of it seems to be centered around black people have messed us over. Man, they picked on us. They treated us. How can in Alabama at a time where they're still like lynching black people and like putting it in the paper and having fun about it? Boggle, or it doesn't boggle my mind. The godmother. It doesn't boggle my mind at all. Next. The fighting all the time. They called them savages. Yes, yes, yes. I thought jabs at black people. They say we Africans try to raise our children right. When they say we ignorant, we got together and built a schoolhouse. Then the county send us a teacher. We African men don't wait like the other colored people till the white folks get ready to build us a school. In my view, and not to say that that doesn't happen, but I could see the godmother being pleased with a statement like that. We've done programs where black people went out and built their own schools. We've had guests on the program. We talked about this legacy before. You can go back and check the archives or do your own research. And whites did a lot to subvert, sabotage those efforts as well. Next. Kasula learns about the law. The whole section about the train, I thought that sounded a little bit closer to the truth, unfortunately. Actually, going down the stretch of the book, I felt like they have slipped a Negro trauma drama in on us. That's what I felt like going down the close of the book, that this sounds like a really sneaky version of the new American classic, The Hate U Give, with a lot of anti-blackness and black death, just scene after scene after scene of black death. I can understand why a Charlotte Mason or a race soldier in 2018 would want to promote a book like this. And I keep in mind from the report that we read, Zora Neale Hurston walked away from this project. This was not something that she was jumping up and down. If that report is accurate, that she walked away, retracted her manuscript, this was not something that she was, you know, celebrating and lauding as, yes, this is a masterpiece. This is my seminal literary creation. I don't think that was the case, unless I've been misinformed. But the godmother, her influence, I can tell. I mean, the whole way reading through the book, I cannot say I had the same. I was repulsed. I'll put it that way. I was repulsed, and it was difficult for me to have the same sort of connection and empathy to the characters because of the influence of this white woman who's financing the project. Like even the scenes where they're eating watermelon together, I view that very differently with her. I just go back to the dedicate. I mean, that might be the most important line in the book. The dedication. I'll just read it again, and then I'll check if anybody has a final comment, and we'll conclude the dedication to the godmother. My godmother and the one mother with a capital M of all the primitives who with the gods in space is concerned about the hearts of the untaught. And that's all I have to say. Any folks, a final word that they can get in 60 seconds or less? Everyone satisfied? We'll assume folks are grand. With that.
Can I be heard?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
I was trying, but you didn't hear me. I'll try to be real quick. The part where you spoke about the beatings, you felt like that might be slave logic. Well, it could be because I know the people on the continent have been affected just as bad as we have, I mean, currently. But I can say that I witnessed when I lived in Ghana for 3.5 years, and I visited Senegal some years ago, and I actually witnessed that behavior. When they do something wrong, the people don't wait for the police like we do over here or stand around and watch somebody being abused. They go and take care of the problem. That's mostly because the police have to come in a cab, okay? So they're not available, so they take care of business. And young girls have a certain haircut if they're underage, and if any man messes with them and you ask what happened to that, where's Mr. So-and-so? They'll tell you he traveled. Get it?
Gotcha.
Okay. The other quick comment, if I still have time, is about the conflict.
20 seconds.
Promoted. It's definitely, if you see the thing going on with Dane Calloway and the We're Not Africans, and then the promotion of immigrant Africans to high status over here, it's obviously being promoted. Thank you for taking my call.
Much obliged, first-time caller. And promotion of conflict between non-white people have to, Dr. Wells, and we're going to maintain the system of white supremacy. Keep that going. Keep them focused on each other. Fight it out. Claw it out. That's great. Spend as much time as possible on that. That, in my view, is why if all the individuals who assert they're a little bit less confused about racism, white supremacy, in my view, one of the major ways that we demonstrate that, really making an effort to minimize conflict. Like, I'm going to make that the number one priority, perhaps. If I am in contact with another non-white person, I'm going to minimize conflict, try to make it as constructive as possible, and make that really maybe my, that'll be my primary responsibility to make sure this is as constructive as possible, really make an effort to minimize conflict in every way that I can that's under my control. Counter-racist code, logic, in my view. We're almost done. We've read like 80% of the book. We'll finish the last little tidbit next week at some point. It will not be at this time because I will be teaching my yoga class, hopefully successfully, this time next Friday or somewhere about this time next Friday. Anywho, if you have comments, feel free to drop an email. If you would like the article, I already posted it, but if you missed it somehow or are not able to do a search or what have you, you can drop me an email and I will send it to you. Again, much obliged to the investor for passing along that constructive report. We'll be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. The compensatory call-in, dial in. We'll catch up on news reports from the last 7 days. Interesting results from the election in Ferguson. We had just talked about that last weekend, I think. Anywho, much obliged to all the folks who dialed in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will again suggest, I think, Mr. Kasula, that was a part of their code, post quote-unquote emancipation, sobriety would be best. Recognize the danger of alcohol. If you're going to be out and frolicking, enjoying last little bits of summer sunshine, grand, you still want to be codified. Race soldiers do not pause just because it's warm weather. Dr. Welsing and many others, they would strongly advise us to take excellent care of our brain computers so that we can think clearly and make great decisions. It is a dangerous, dangerous environment, the system of white supremacy. We do not want to be intoxicated and in such an environment not thinking clearly. As such, when we're out and about in a vehicle. In addition to being sober, we want to be buckled up every time, driver or passenger. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.